Desert and the great American Southwest. I bid you all good evening, good afternoon, good morning, whatever the appropriate salutation would be for this time of day, because we cover all of them in the world's time zones covered by Coast to Coast AM. This is the weekend edition. And I've got so much I've got to get out here. We are going to do open lines this hour, so get ready for that. Open lines coming up. But, oh man, you don't frequently have a night where you've got so much good stuff on the website to throw your way. I took my webcam back to a picture of me a couple of minutes ago because everything else is posted as it should be. We've got some really wicked stuff up there for you. I told you last night the Hampton Court ghost is clearly the paranormal picture of the year. Well, now it's a little more than that. We've got it all on the website. The Hampton Court ghost, the video. That's right. We've got the video for you along with a little British commentary. And then at the very end, a moving GIF image of the ghost actually opening the doors, making the appearance in the picture you've all seen now, so famous, and then closing the doors. And baby, we've got it on the website, coasttocoastam.com. That's item one. Like, that'd be enough all by itself. But item two comes rolling into my email, as usual, toward the end of the day today, in the form of... Well, you don't very frequently, even doing what I do, get good, clear shots of a saucer. I've got one. Now, this may turn out to be, there may turn out to be a reasonable, logical explanation for what you're about to see, but I sure don't know what it is. A man named Thomas, and if he wants to identify himself any further than that, because I've got him here on the phone, sent me an email along with this photograph, which is, in terms of being detailed and clear, class A, 10 on a scale of 10. Now, this is a photograph of a saucer on the desert floor near Sedona, Arizona. In a moment, I'll have Thomas on because... bless his heart. I wish more people would do this so we could understand the providence of a photograph that we're about to examine. But he gave me his phone number, and so I called him up. I said, hey, gotta come on the show, right? In a moment, I'll have Thomas explain what you can see. It's under a listener's emails, and boom, there's the photograph of whatever in the hell it is on the floor of the desert near Sedona. Now, you click to get this whole story, which he sent, and the large photograph. And it is a very large, very clear photograph. Now, as I said, there may turn out to be some very conventional explanation for what an apparent flying saucer would be doing, sitting in broad daylight, perhaps even day after day, in the middle of the desert near Sedona. But I'm looking forward to what that explanation is going to be. In the meantime, if you want to see it, it's at the website, along with the video of the Hampton Court ghost. So look out, Coast to Coast AM, here they come. That's where you want to go, coasttocoastam.com. Two things, the UFO you're about to hear about, well, actually, technically, an unidentified grounded object, because it's on the ground. Looks like it made a soft landing, if in fact it landed at all. I'm telling you, it's really clear. So those who complain about foggy, hard-to-see photographs, prepare yourself for a big shock. We'll tell you the story of it in a moment. All right. I mean, this is a dead, flat, clear, high-res picture of a disc on the ground somewhere in the Sedona area. Here's Thomas. Thomas, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Are you doing tonight?
I beg your pardon?
How are you doing tonight?
I'm fine. Did you decide to just, like, send this off to me this afternoon? Is that it just came to you?
Well, let me tell you what happened.
Yeah, please.
My brother and his fiance were visiting here from Sacramento area, mm-hmm. California. And
you're where in Arizona? Where?
I'm sorry, I'm in Phoenix, Arizona.
You're in Phoenix, all right.
Yes.
Okay.
And they came for a visit last weekend and had reservations to stay up in the Sedona area. And to make a long story short, they came home yesterday back to my house here in Phoenix. And in talking to them, his fiance pulls out this picture that she said she got while they were up there. And at first, I didn't know what it was about. I took a look at it, and I said, oh, my God.
Yeah.
You've got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
This is exciting.
It's that kind of photograph.
I couldn't believe it. I said, what is this?
Yeah.
This is for real?
Yeah.
And what they told me was that they had rented a plane to fly to the Grand Canyon.
Ah.
Private plane.
Ah, yes.
Out of Sedona. And en route to the Grand Canyon, they had flown over this saucer, laying there on the desert floor.
Check. They just
and
flew over the
pilot floor. Pointed it out to them, and they just, you know, their jaws dropped. And
the pilot, I mean, what did he say? Ladies and gentlemen, to the left side of the aircraft now, you'll see a flying saucer on the ground in the desert. I mean, what?
Yeah.
Something like that.
That happens all the time, right? And, you know, he told a story about it, and what he told them was that he had been flying another couple up to the Grand Canyon area.
Yeah.
It last July.
Yeah.
Now, this is a pilot very familiar with the area. He has flown over the same route for years. Okay?
The guy takes people on Grand Canyon tours, folks. So he traverses the same ground all the time.
Yeah. He has never seen this object before. This was in July of this year.
He had never seen it.
A couple happened to spot it and point it out to him.
Okay, he had never seen it prior to that.
He had never seen it prior to that.
Okay.
That's his story. And so, at some other, I'm assuming at some other flight over the area, he had taken more pictures of the craft.
He obviously got down on deck and took a very close photograph, actually.
Yeah,
so what we seem to have here, folks, I don't know, it's a disc, it's a saucer, and damned if it doesn't look like the door is open.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it really does look
like
it.
There's no doubt there's a door open there.
It does seem to be a door.
And if you
really
look,
does.
I don't know if you're looking at it, Art.
I'm looking at it.
But to the left, on the left-hand side, about 45 degrees from the door, you can see looks like a couple of pipes sticking out there. I don't know if you noticed that.
No, wait a minute. Where are the pipes?
At about, I'm sorry, 90 degrees from.
Oh, I do see that. I do see it.
See that?
Yes.
I'm
yes,
not
I
sure
do.
What that is. I don't know if it's a ladder to get up on top of the craft.
I don't either.
Or what it is.
I mean, this is a flying saucer on the ground. Give me a break. It is just a flying saucer on the ground. And you know, it looks like. I wouldn't exactly call that a road. I don't know what it's like a path.
It looks like a path
through the desert. Out. Something came or went several times.
Exactly. Yeah. And if you look at the saucer, it looks like it's got, you know, heat tiles on it.
Yeah.
Around the circumference.
Yeah, they could
it
be
like
heat tiles.
You've seen heat tiles?
It does look like heat tiles. And then off to the left of the saucer in the desert, there's what appears to be a kind of a clear material or something, almost clear material.
It looks like it may perhaps have skipped on the ground once. As what
very good point. That's exactly what that
you know
what
is. I mean? It looks like it may have skipped once and then
there's
landed.
A burn area there, or a
yes.
I'd say burn area.
Yeah, you know, that was my thought.
Holy crap, Thomas.
And judging from just from the road tracks, I'm estimating here, but I'd say it's maybe 45 feet in diameter. I don't know.
You're judging that based on the width of
the trail path
or whatever you want to call it?
The tracks coming in.
Yeah.
And then, you know, putting that across the
yeah, maybe that's a good guess. That might be a good guess.
Yeah.
It's just not every day that somebody sends you a photograph like this, Thomas. So you can imagine I sat here and I went, huh.
I'm sure your jaw dropped just like mine did.
It did.
I believe it when I saw this.
You know, and I've been doing this stuff for a lot of years.
I have to contact Art Bell with this picture because he's not going to believe this.
You're right.
I don't know if you've ever seen it before or seen it.
No, because if this thing's
been sitting in the desert since July, I just can't believe that it's never been reported before.
Now, you mentioned something in your email about this pilot having been grilled, your words, by a variety of, in quotes, agents.
Yes, sir. That is what he had told my brother and his fiancé, that he had been...
The FBI, CIA...
...subjected to,
somebody.
You know, the treatment from the guys in black.
And what did he pass on what they had said or instructed?
No,
I mean, did they say, like, hey, you're not going to be talking about this?
Give me art, but the story is all secondhand. And so I'm just trying to relate to you what I heard about what happened. The pilot apparently has taken about half a dozen more shots of the craft, and he has them in his possession.
How close is this to Sedona proper? Any idea?
I am, from what my brother had told me, it's somewhere in the area of 50 miles. And
50,
I don't know which direction
miles.
I would assume. In the
so it's really out.
In Canyon.
This, I assume, is truly out in the middle of essentially nowhere.
Exactly. I heard it's very hostile country.
Yeah.
If it's been laying there since July, it appears that perhaps the craft was too heavy to attempt to move it. And the terrain may not have allowed that.
You know, it's funny. I was trying to figure out what that other mark was there. And you, of course, are correct now that I look at it correctly. As you have mentioned, it probably hit first there. Another scenario could be, of course, that it was driven there by whatever in the hell came up that, if you want to call it a road, it's not a road, it's a path. Whatever came up, oh, my gosh.
I was so excited about this, I couldn't wait to pass it on to somebody else because I've been listening to your program for years, and I just have been fascinated with the kind of stories that you've had.
Is there any conventional explanation that you could think of offhand, Thomas, for this? I mean,
well, I'll tell you what. I did contact Whitley Strieber's people as well.
Whitley? Mm-hmm.
And sent them a copy of the picture.
What did they say?
And... I got a reply back from them today suggesting perhaps, and it, you know, I don't know. This is all, who knows. If I may quote.
You may.
This could be an experimental disc, they write. The U.S. Air Force did quite a bit of this type of experimentation back a few years ago.
Yeah.
The road leading up to it is well-traveled and not of recent construction, suggesting that it could be a structure that has been there for a while.
Wow.
And again, it's always possible that it's a genuine unknown.
Yeah.
And we will see if we can find anything else with a similar shape.
Well,
end quote.
Maybe you found it, Thomas. I sure wish I knew what those, in quotes, agencies said about all of this.
I would be as interested as well. I'm telling you, the pilot...
And of course, interviewing the pilot would be a good idea, too.
Would be a very good idea. He was very affable. And
affable.
Very open about it.
Do you have any way of getting me the name or number?
Yes, I've already.
Oh, good.
My brother just landed. I just heard from them about 25 minutes ago.
Uh huh.
And they just got home from leaving this area.
In the meantime, maybe it's a good thing that people don't know exactly where this is right now.
Exactly.
Or after tonight, why they pick it to pieces. Man, this is incredible. I just, you know, maybe it's one of ours, but I don't remember us making anything like that.
Well, if we did, they certainly didn't tell us about it.
Well, listen, buddy, that's it then. That's all you know about this thing, right?
As much as I can tell you for now, Art, and if you want to get in contact with me, I'll be happy to share as much information as I can with you.
Well, you called the right place, Thomas. Thank you.
Thank you, Art.
And I'll be in touch.
All right. Good night now.
Good night. Now, there may be a perfectly reasonable explanation for this, but I definitely can't think of one right now. Out in the unknown parts of the desert, somewhere outside Sedona. Now, the picture again taken by a pilot who was conducting tours to the Grand Canyon, you know, air tours. And he spotted the thing. He came in low and took a photograph. And that's what you're seeing here. And it definitely, would merit investigation from some agency, wouldn't you? I mean, no matter what it is, it's nothing normal. It sure looks like a saucer with the door open. And so there you have it. And I thought it would be well worthwhile taking up a few minutes at the beginning of the program. Don't blame me if this turns out to have a very conventional explanation, though I can't imagine what it would be. It's not my fault. But go ahead and take a look at the picture and see what you think. Obviously, somebody doing a program like this is not going to turn down a picture like that. Yikes. All right, news-wise, what's going on? The government on Sunday raised the national threat level to orange, indicating high risk of terrorist attack. Said threat indicators are perhaps greater now than at any point since September 11th, 2001. With strikes possible during the holidays, Americans were promised extensive and considerable protections around the country and told to stick to their travel plans, despite intelligence indicating Al-Qaeda may be seeking again to use airplanes as weapons and exploit suspected weaknesses in U.S. aviation security. There's nothing laughable about this. Except the fact that they're saying Al-Qaeda probably is going to use airplanes again. They're probably going to do something. But, you know, if you've got a plane trip planned, don't worry about it. Go ahead. All right. I understand for the sake of the economy, that would be their wish. And certainly I understand that you just can't live your life afraid of these jerks. You just can't. The odds of your getting hijacked and rammed into a building are, you know, smaller than probably a crash for some other reason. Libya hopes to reopen relations with us, the West, and begin to sign lucrative oil deals with companies here. That after the day after, as a matter of fact, they said they were going to turn in their weapons of mass destruction and join the world community and embrace us all. So now they'd like some big oil contracts. And they'll probably get them. Acting on intelligence gleaned from the capture of Saddam Hussein, which that would indicate that he's talking, right? U.S. troops rounded up dozens of suspected rebels during 2 days of raids in towns where loyalty to the deposed president remains strong. So this means that we've been having a chat with Saddam. And as I understand it, Saddam was turned over to the CIA. And that they are actively questioning him. And apparently getting some answers because they're rounding up bad guys really quickly. So I guess Saddam has decided that speaking is the better part of valor in whatever situation. I mean, what kind of situation do you think they have him in right now? You don't imagine he's laying back on the couch watching an NFL almost playoff game, right? They're probably asking him really hard questions. And who knows where they've got him. And I don't think anybody out here is really worried about the nature and the manner of the questioning, right? So apparently we're getting some pretty good info. Now listen to me. On the 28th, I shall be here filling in for George. Actually, on the 26th, and then the 28th, and then the following Sunday, of course, the 31st, I'll be here. And this is very important. On the 28th, and then on Sunday, the 31st, as we begin the new year, I will do the traditional thing that we have done now for well over a decade, and I will take predictions for two nights, whatever all else we're doing. For two nights, I will take predictions on the air for the year 2004. You're only allowed to make one prediction, so I want you to consider it very carefully. We want our hit rate to go up. Now, the only way that can happen is if you really make a shot at doing this right. And that means relaxing your mind, sit back, tune out the world, and try and open your mind to some event that's going to occur in the year 2004. And after you've made that serious attempt, I'll only take one prediction from you during those two nights. You call me, I'll number them, and we'll see how your paranormal level checks out at the end of the year. It's an awful lot of fun. The 28th and then the 31st from the high desert in the middle of the night doing what we do here. This is Coast to Coast AM. That's right. Don't touch that dial.
With Art Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
You know, it really, wouldn't it be something? I mean, I'm sure there's a conventional explanation for this apparent flying saucer right in the middle of the desert. There's got to be something, right? But just suppose for a second that there isn't. Suppose that we just found the great giant smoking gun, or in this case, saucer, even though it's not smoking. I mean, we found the real McCoy. Just like this. Boom. There it is. Wouldn't that be something? The other, of course, possibility is that it is photoshopped in there, but I don't think so. Now, I know the pixel people out there will fiendishly go to work on this, and they'll blow it up to the umpteenth pixel, and I'm sure I'll be getting reports shortly. But it doesn't look that way. Shadows look pretty good. Looking at the edges looks pretty good. I'll leave it to the pixel people. They do look like tiles on there, as he mentioned, though. All right, first-time caller line, you are on the air. Good evening.
Hello.
Hello.
I didn't know I was going to be on the air.
You didn't? No. Well, what do you think we do here? Make hot dogs?
No.
It's a radio program. We're going to have to agree to be on the air. I can't put you on the air. So
I'm with you.
You agree?
I just wanted to
in writing to be on the air.
Okay.
All right. Okay.
I just wanted to make sure that you realize that that's absolutely legitimate, and I'll tell you why I know.
Are you talking about the saucer?
The saucer. Absolutely.
The way you said that, it's like you're from New Jersey.
Well, no, I'm at this point in Utah.
Where are you originally from, though?
Well, originally I'm from Memphis, Tennessee, years way back, but I lived in New York and also...
I knew it. Yeah, okay. Yes. Well, that's how the salsa got there. All right, so you know this is genuine. Now, that's quite a statement to make just based on having seen the photograph. I mean, how can you be saying that?
Well, I happen to be capable of detecting the frequencies of any kind of material on this earth and things that are off the earth. So,
oh, that's a serious talent.
Yes.
But how do you do that?
Well, I'm afraid words can't explain it. It's sort of like psychic energy. You know what I mean?
Ah. And so when you saw this, psychic energy leapt off the screen to you.
Right. I can feel it. I can take any photograph, and I can check it to see if the frequencies are from this world or from other worlds. And this photograph is from another world. I can even tell if it's been worked on by people from this planet. And it hasn't been. It has only frequencies of off-planet.
That's it, huh?
That's it.
I mean, you're not even in doubt. You're just certain.
I have no doubt whatsoever. Now, if you want to get a little background on who I am, I can give you my website. I can do it off air.
Well, that's all right. I don't have anybody to take it off air here, so I'll just have to.
Oh, I see. You're working alone.
One-man band.
I didn't know that.
Well, see, there you are. Yeah, I run the board and the music and the phone calls and everything. All right, thank you very much. Well, some talent, huh? Well, there's a little authentication for the photograph, folks. The frequency's coming off it. Should have had him sign it. Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, Art.
Hello.
Calling from El Paso, Texas.
El Paso. Yes, indeed.
My wife and daughter and I, we were amongst about 1,000 extras in Roland Emmerich's movie A Day After Tomorrow in April. When they
They're kidding!
Yes, we got to be refugees. We were classified as refugees on foot.
You were a refugee in Roland Emmerich's new movie, which is based in part on the coming global superstorm. You were extras, really?
Yeah, we heard about it just kind of by accident. We went down and applied. They actually paid us. I got about $350. It paid for a scanner I bought.
Way cool. What did you have to do as a refugee, or should you not tell me?
Oh, no, it's fine. In fact, have you seen the trailer?
Oh, yes.
We appear briefly for 2 seconds in the crowd in the trailer on this. There's a scene where we have to try to get into Mexico on a bridge. Then another one, we were trying to get across the river.
I guess being an extra, you don't get a sense of the larger story in the movie, do you?
Not really, except the assistant directors wander around saying, okay, people, remember the planet's undergoing wacky weather and everyone's dead and you're trying to get south, so, you know, look sad, look... I'm freaked out. It's hard because it's so funny. It's hilarious. You know, it's hard work, but it was a heck of a lot of fun.
Yeah, television and the movies, they are hard work. There's no question about it.
Millions here, though.
Oh, I'm sure. Listen,
it was a huge refugee camp. It was, you know, about half mile on a side. They had thousands of, well, hundreds at least, of RVs and cars.
Oh, yeah. Did you have a very dejected, refugee-like looking face? I mean, did you manage that?
Sort of. We wore pretty grubby clothes, or I guess translates just into my regular weekend clothes.
Right, but you're supposed to look dejected, right?
Probably never got that close to our faces. I mean, we were part of masses of tired refugees. Like, in one scene, we had to carry bags of rice. There were supposed to be 50-kilo bags of rice from the U.S. Army truck passing them out.
Well, the trailer is kick butt.
Yeah,
no question about it. It's going to be a really good movie.
Yeah, we looked at it pixel by pixel, and we think we spotted us there on the bridge.
Pixel by pixel, huh?
Yeah.
Well, rolling, baby, we're depending on you. All right, sir, thank you.
Bye.
Take care. That's, I don't know if you've seen it. If you've been to the movies, they're now showing it in the movie theaters, you know, as a tease. It is a hell of a trailer for The Day After Tomorrow, based in part on the coming global superstorm. And so... obviously, there'll be much more about that, but we're all very anxiously waiting to see how it's going to turn out. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Yeah, how you doing?
I'm doing great, sir.
I'm a first-time caller. I'm a bit nervous here.
It's all right. Take a deep breath. That's what I learned. Big, deep breath.
And that's better.
There you go. It is. Really is. Does work. So what's up?
Well, I just have a bizarre sighting, I guess you would call it.
Oh?
Tonight, coming home from a gig. I play music.
Tonight?
Yes.
Okay.
Actually, well, Sunday night, the 19th for me. It's
and
now
where are you?
I'm in Manassas.
Okay, and you were coming home from a gig.
From a gig, yes, playing music. And I got out of my car, and I'm coming into the house, and it's a beautiful night. I love to look at the stars. I have a telescope. You know, I listen to your show all the time. And so I glance up, beautiful, clear sky, looking towards Orion. And as I glance up, I'm looking back down. I thought I saw, like, three or four falling stars at once. So I look back up, and they're still there, and they're moving. Mm-hmm. And there's more than just three or four. There's, like, a whole column. These gray disc-looking or circular shapes moving across the sky.
Right.
In rows of maybe three, four, five, six, maybe nine at the most, going across. In this long column moving roughly southwest to northeast.
Gotcha.
Towards Dulles Airport. And just very bizarre.
And so you stood and...
I was dumbfounded. I'm looking up at this, watching this, and it's completely silent.
You go into a kind of a shock is actually what happens. You, you know, everything gets suspended for a moment, and you realize you're seeing something...
Well, it just didn't look right.
Yeah.
You know, I look back up, and the impression that I get was as if you're in a planetarium. You know, someone's got these lights shining, and they're moving them across the night sky in a planetarium.
Could you judge altitude and by that have a guess at how many other people might have seen this?
Oh, man. I'm right over the flight path going into Dulles, and it was maybe that altitude of where the planes are,
yes.
Roughly that speed. Maybe higher, though. I mean, for all I know, they were way, way up.
A whole lot of people should have seen.
Well, but if they were low and small, I don't know. They look like they might have been roughly at about that altitude the planes come in on.
Well, I guess all I can say is welcome to the great international club of people who've seen stuff.
Yeah, it was bizarre. It was when I looked up, I didn't see the beginning of it. I saw the end of it. And
right.
It was anywhere from, like, 20, 30 on up to, I don't know, but it was this column, you know, and it looked like something out of Mars Attacks. You know, I mean, it just had that, no, really, this column, this sort of like a column moving across the sky, silently, slowly, and then it was gone.
I don't know what to tell you, except, welcome. I mean, that's it. I can say welcome to the club, and more than half of Americans have seen things they cannot explain in our skies. And I'm one of them, so welcome. You know, that's worth a little bit of thought when you consider that most people don't look at the sky very much. And for that many people to have seen UFOs makes it a subject well worthy of investigation. Hell, maybe we got one here on the ground in Sedona. What is that thing, anyway? West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, Art.
Yes, hi.
Yeah, well, here's a popular explanation for you. My name's Adam from Littleton, Colorado.
Yo, Adam.
Yeah, swamp gas out there in the desert. Yeah.
You think that's swamp gas?
Well, you know, when you...
Why would there be heat tiles on swamp gas?
When you look at the way the government's treated us.
One other thing, it's near Sedona, which is in the middle of the desert. You know, there's not a lot of swamp gas there.
I understand. When you look at the way the government's treated us in regards to the way they do the investigations, if I come across something like that, I mean, I'm not going to tell a government agency. I'm going to do my own investigations, call every citizens investigative group, you know, MUFON, Citizens Against UFO Secrecy.
Okay, but you have seen the picture, honestly.
I haven't seen the picture. I'm being, you know, sarcastic.
Oh,
you know,
you haven't even seen the picture. Gas, you know. Oh, jeez.
Of course, it's not swamp gas, but
well,
that's
right.
What the government's going to tell you. I'm just being sarcastic.
I got you. Yeah. Well, I suggest you go take a look at this picture before somebody explains it, because I mean, you might think it's Mars Attacks or something. If you were to just first see it, you're going to go UFO. Now, further investigation may show many things, and it may be explained in one of many conventional ways, and I want to stress that. But, I mean, first blush, there it is, folks, a saucer in the middle of the damn desert, just with nothing around, in a place where, well, everybody could have missed it. Ah, the possibilities. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
This is Larry. I'm calling from Oklahoma.
On a cell phone, too, at that, huh, Larry?
Yeah.
Yep.
And listening off of a Tulsa radio station.
Tulsa, okay. And so what's up?
Well, I have an answer to a question which comes up just about every night on your program.
Wow, that's frequent. What is it? The question.
The question is who are they?
Who are they?
Well, I was referring to they.
Okay, and the answer
and
is?
Who is the secret so-called people that are pulling strings in the world?
Okay, go ahead and give us the answers. Who are they?
Okay, and I'll just say I know who they are.
I know you already said that, so tell us, who are they?
Okay, it's the cabal of families.
A cabal of families.
Yeah, and...
Do the wild thing at 775-727-1295.
No, see, you don't get to do that. Start reading off names. We don't allow that on the program. Should have known that. But he had a whole bunch of family names ready. We're not going to air that. Especially after we've called them they. So you all will have to continue to wonder. Wildcard line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi. Let's not call it us and them.
All right. Turn your radio off first, and then us
all right,
and them. Okay.
I'm turning the radio off.
Thank you. So you think it's a collective we, huh?
Pretty much. When I say collective we,
Hold it. Turn your radio off.
All right, granted.
A second chance.
I turned it off to the best of my ability.
All right, your ability is going to have to get better. Turn it all the way off.
All right.
Or I'll have to leave the line.
All right, I'm turning off all the circuits.
Okay, well, east of the Rockies, you would have been on the air. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yeah, I have a fantastic sighting that I've never been able to report to either Peter Davenport or Artville.
This is Art. You've got me. So if you've got a good one, let her loose.
Okay. I'm on now?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. I had a experience about 2 years ago in August, September, somewhere around that range, of a UFO sighting in Fresno, California. There was a teacher that apparently had saw this on the air. It was aired on TV as well. It has happened at 4:20 in the morning.
Okay.
I saw literally a 40-minute show from 4:20 to 5:00, and they had lights going around it. It looked like it had been a triangular type of ship. I stood out there. I was amazed. I ran out in the street where there was more street where it could have seen me. It was about 6 miles southeast of me, and I'm in central Fresno. I jumped up, down, waved my arms, thinking that how would it ever see me at that distance? But it did. It came forward towards me.
You think it responded to you?
Pardon?
You think?
Yeah,
it
did. It did respond. I mean, after a few minutes, and it came forward, and then it went back. Then a small plane started coming over from the airport, so it darted real quick to the south end of Fresno.
Huh.
Then it came back, and then after the plane had gone, it came back, and then it went over to the other direction, north, and disappeared.
Were you by yourself?
Yeah, I was by myself. It was 4:20 in the morning, and it was a very clear night.
All right, so obviously if a TV got hold of it, then they must have had footage or got word of it
a teacher had reported it. And
yeah,
I saw no one was awake at 4:20. I'm sure very few people probably have seen it. It came back in the original place, and then it disappeared. It came back, and what is amazing, it started getting light out about 5:00 at night. I had my binoculars. I zoomed in on it and had green, different bluish green lights going around it, and I zeroed in on it, and it started getting light out, so I could actually saw the shape of the ship was octagon. It looked like it was octagon.
Uh-huh.
And I could see the silvery, like the regular jet aircraft type of color to it, I had it zeroed right in at 5:00 in the morning, and then it got so light out that it was getting hard to see it, but I could zero it in for a while, and then it took off.
So clearly you think you saw a craft from another world.
I don't know if it was experimental. I don't know if it was from another world, but I'll tell you what,
that's a good answer.
Did things that I've never seen anything from this planet do. I know that.
That's a good answer. It's the same one I gave. I saw a triangular craft, very, very, throw a rock kind of close, No question about what it was, but at the end of it, I said, yep, it could have been one of ours.
Yeah, well, this thing was octagon, though. It was actually octagon. I could see it very clearly.
How would you would you describe its movement, sir? Was it flying or was it floating?
You know, the thing is, there was no sound at all, and it was
no
just
sound.
Like it was just sitting up there for the longest time. I had a 40-minute show, literally, and it was sitting there mostly in one spot.
Hovering.
Yeah, just like hovering. And there was no sound to it, and when it moved, it just moved real, you know, like any it came forward, you know, right straight at me, and then it came back, you know, it went back. I got kind of like, you know, paranoid when it started coming close to me. I started looking at my front door like, man, I want to go in the house. I had jury duty, you know, next week, and I sure as hell didn't want to get taken up, you know.
Maybe we're beginning to have a pretty good size flap. I mean, I'm getting all these reports. I've got a photograph of something here on the ground.
Yeah. Well, this
it's
was
pretty
now, this
crazy.
Is, this is 2 years ago, though.
Yeah.
This is 2 years ago, around in August. I believe it was two. Yeah, I think it was 2 years ago. And a lady had a teacher had reported it on one of the local TV stations that she had seen. I think it's the same one she saw. But this is 4:20 in the morning. I was taking care of the guy's lawn next door because, you know, there was no one there, and I had to, you know, water the lawn at night, and I was out there getting it all watered up. And I had to that's why I was up so late.
Well, you still sound every bit as excited as I bet you were when you saw it. I mean, you can tell you're very excited about it.
I did. I left word with Peter Davenport, but I never returned the call on it, though. So, but it was interesting. It was quite a sight to see.
Well, I don't know what to say about it, except like I did to the earlier fellow who had a really good report. Welcome to the club.
Yeah.
The ever-growing club.
They're there.
And there's no question about the club growing. Thank you very much.
Sure thing.
Take care. And the club really is growing. There's something going on out there. Ron Fink is coming up after the break, and we're going to talk about robots. That's what he's right in the middle of, robots. I wonder how many of you got to see the Sony robot, the incredibly articulating Sony robot. Well, we'll ask about that a whole lot more, because he's involved. Ron is involved in robotics. From the high desert in the middle of the night, man, get up there and take a look at that saucer sitting on the ground somewhere out there outside Sidonia. I'm sure there's a really good explanation for this. Probably.
Chaka, hookah, hookah, hookah.
Girl, you just don't realize
chaka, hookah, hookah,
what you do to me.
Chaka, hookah, hookah, chaka, hookah,
when you hold
hookah,
me
chaka, hookah,
in your arms
hookah,
so
chaka,
tight,
hookah,
you let me know
hookah, chaka, hookah,
everything's
alright.
Hooked on a feeling, that's candy, it's taste, it's on my mind. Girl, you got me thirsty for another cup of wine. Got a bug from you, girl, but I don't need a cure. I just stay up and can if I can for sure.
To talk with Art Bell, call the wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is indeed, and I don't think anybody knows what that saucer is. Let me read you some of the responses I'm getting fast-blasted to me. Jack in Tucson, these are all in a row, in Tucson, Arizona, says, hey, Art, the saucer-like object outside Sedona is actually a storage container for cattle feed. Nice try. French fry. Cheers. J-A-C. Or Ray in Doraville, Georgia. I know for sure the photo of the saucer is a cover to an airplane wheel. The cover looks bigger than it really is. It's from an old biplane. My dad worked with him. Then Ray in Adorville. Same Ray, I guess. Sorry, same message. Don says, Renton, Washington, they are DS-8. This came out on a recent sci-fi special. So everybody thinks it's everything. And nobody knows for sure, apparently, what it is. Lots of good guesses, though. It'll be interesting as time goes on to see if it's a Photoshop special or who knows. But, I mean, there it is. Out in the middle of nowhere, have your own go at it. Be my guest. All right, coming up in a moment, Ron Mad Max Fink. Anybody with a name like Mad Max, you got to look out for. He has time and time again shattered all previous notions of what technology can do in the 70s. He created his own voice recognition system in the 80s. His ideas contributed to missile defense systems that could maintain the focus of light over thousands of mirrors. Maybe that's where they got the smoke and mirrors thing. Star Wars. Ron also designed and programmed an entire line of 80-plus artificial intelligence robots for a major company. In the 90s, he developed real-time map-based GIS tracking software for inventory asset management and logistics for two major companies. Sounds like he was getting into a lot more serious work in the 90s, huh? His team tied to, well, more serious in the sense of, I've got to get out there and make some money. His team tied together phone systems, voice recognition systems, legacy systems, power grid control slash monitoring systems, and major accounting systems in record time and with no, and that's in capitals, no programming errors. He even made enough spare time to found a charity, where he reached out to America's best untapped minds and gave them the focus and training to succeed. In the 2000s, his team designed voice interactive navigation systems currently installed in a variety of cars around the world. I wonder if we should call him Mad Max. In a moment. Let's see. Frank in San Diego says, fake picture art, shadow of the saucer is a dead giveaway when you blow it way up. Or Mike in Anchorage, Alaska says, think it might be a really good tabletop model, top scale. Look at the lower right. It doesn't quite look real. Anyway, I hope I'm wrong and it's real. So that's the kind of response we're getting to the photograph. You know, who knows? I mean, you throw it up there. And eventually one of the saucers will stick. All right. Is it Ron or Ron Fink or Mad Max?
Well, some of my friends call me Trace.
Trace, really?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, it's short for Trace Huevos.
I see. I kind of like, I lean toward Mad Max.
Okay.
Says something about you, I guess, doesn't it?
Yeah. The
what does it say about you, actually?
The bottom line is that I've always been willing to take on the projects that nobody else thought was possible.
All right. You're into robotics, am I right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, then. I'm going to ask you the standard question that I ask of all robot-type people, and I don't get very many, by the way. People love robotics, artificial intelligence, that kind of thing. All right. Here it is. Just bear with me.
Okay.
When I was growing up, I was born in 1945, end of the war, baby, and I watched all the science fiction movies like everybody else, and I was promised that by the time I got to be the age I am now, oh my God, the world would be a place in which every undesirable task, every drudgery, piece of drudgery and junk that I had to do in my life would be taken care of by robots. It would be the land of milk, honey, and gears. It would just be wonderful. Robots would be everywhere. It hadn't happened yet.
Well, a lot of people, react to the same marketing, the exact opposite way. They think that it's going to be like Skynet and Matrix. So I guess there's a few different views about what robotics will bring.
Well, we were sort of promised that
yes,
and it didn't happen. Now I understand there have been recent great strides in robotics. Did you happen to see the Sony robot, the new Sony?
I'm familiar with the AIBO. They have a new one. I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, that's really cool. CNN had it. The articulation on it is unbelievable.
They're getting really good.
Yeah, they really are getting good, but it should have happened by now. I mean, truly, all the drudgery work, by you still got to do it. And
yes, it's true.
So we haven't, it's not the land of milk and honey yet, but what kind of robotics are you involved in?
Well, currently, what we are trying to do is build an automobile that can pilot itself entirely. It understands roads. It understands people and other vehicles. It understands about signs. It understands about barbed wire fences and downed power lines and anything else you can think of.
Now, you're telling me this car would be able to, in today's environment, and I'm talking about putting it out on streets and highways with other cars occupied by humans, it would be able to navigate under those conditions?
Yes.
How?
I'm glad you asked. First, let me give you a little background.
Okay.
DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which is a division of Department of Defense, the DOD.
Yes, they're the folks who are funding, among other things, HAARP.
Yes.
So what about DARPA?
Well, DARPA has been funding research into autonomous vehicles since about 1990.
Figures.
They've been mandated by Congress to have one-third of all ground supply-line vehicles be autonomous by the year 2015. And so they started letting out projects and research grants and so forth. And almost $2 billion into it, they don't have results yet. And so Congress authorized them to issue...
What exactly is it they want again, please?
Well, you see, they need some of their ground vehicles to be autonomous so that they can go into war-torn areas early.
Right.
With medicines and supplies. And,
makes sense, sure.
Right.
Sure.
This was really brought to the front, you know, in some of the recent wars especially.
Oh, yeah, you're making a very good point. I mean, the ground assault on Baghdad, I recall as if it were yesterday. You know, they have the cameras on board the tanks and everything, and by God, there were humans everywhere. And you do wonder in this day and age, why, for example, would a human have to be in a tank necessarily? Yes. Why couldn't there be a guy operating it from, oh, I don't know, suburban Washington, D.C. with a joystick, you know, and a monitor in front of him?
Yeah, well, we're going to take that one step further. We're going to let these vehicles have enough brains so that they can actually take care of themselves.
Oh, repair themselves.
More than that.
More.
Guide themselves completely, autonomously, conduct their business that they've been assigned to conduct. And know their way around by sight. This is going to be quite an achievement.
What about the possibility of Christine? Yeah, you remember Christine?
I remember Christine.
The runaway crazy car that killed.
I remember
killed
that.
All right. So, what would happen if one of your vehicles lost its artificial intelligence?
We are hoping that we can build in ethics.
Ethics?
Yes. Have you read the robotics, the three laws?
The laws?
Of robotics?
Remind me of them. Not to hurt humans, that's
science,
one, right?
Science fiction great Isaac Asimov incorporated the three laws of robotics in all of his robotic stories. And I can't remember the three right off the top
of my head. I know one's not to hurt human beings.
Right.
Thou shall not harm a human being.
Right. And then the next one was, by inaction, you shall not cause a human being to come into harm.
Okay, same thing.
Okay, all right. And I think the last one was...
Wait. Stop on that one. Did you say by inaction,
that's right,
you are not to see harm?
Allow a human to come in.
So in other words, if the robot could in any way prevent harm to a human, whatever other instruction it might have, it would have to do that. Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. So basically what we're structuring that as is ethics. And we actually have ethics built into the very lowest levels of the machine. So there are certain things that it can't do.
Well, now how do you do that?
Well,
I suppose it's a software kind of challenge, really, right?
It is. Well, hardware, too. I mean, we've got 20 64-bit processors in a huge, you know, massively parallel array with more than 20 gigabytes of RAM.
And, wow, a lot of RAM.
Yeah, and, you know, huge terabytes of disk space in order to pull this off. So, and then we've had to invent some new technologies for scanning the globe.
Okay, well, slow way down.
Okay.
Now, we're not all programmers. I'm certainly not a programmer, so
okay.
I can't begin to understand how you would instill what you're using the word ethics to describe into a robotic vehicle. Maybe, can you give us a hint of how you approach such a job?
Let me try that.
Yeah.
Okay. With any computer system, there are levels of programming.
Right.
For example, we deal with a user interface, which is a level of programming that most people refer to as layer 7 in the ISO standards. There's a whole bunch of layers, and down to layer 1, which is the kernel that deals directly with the CPU kind of thing.
Right.
So each of these layers controls different levels of activity in the computer's brain.
Right.
Now, the operating system, for example, is a lower level than the user interface for a program. And so at the lowest levels, every program that works with the computer power, the computer processing power, has to go through these lower levels. Now, if these lower levels can understand the objects that are being manipulated and can actually understand any kind of a relative value of objects and what kind of things might cause harm to those objects, then this lower level can make a judgment call about whether or not it's ethical to proceed.
Huh. So if this vehicle had a large gun on the front of it, let's say.
Okay.
It was a military vehicle probably, right?
Well, we're hoping to obviously do more peaceful uses, like if
well, you don't really have any illusions about DARPA, do you? And you know what they're doing?
Their stated purpose
yeah.
is to you know provide medicines and supplies. To
oh people. Yes, yes, yes. Do you buy that wholly? I mean, DARPA is a
yes. They are a war machine. I understand that. But they're also the people who brought
war
us the
is on their mind, sir. Well, yes, perhaps they did bring us the internet. I don't know. I thought
well,
it was
Al Gore.
Well,
it used to be the ARPANET, and it was put into the public domain and became the internet.
Uh huh. But surely you must have some reservation since it is DARPA, and
yeah.
you know.
Well, the reason we bring up DARPA in the first place is because it is their contest that started off a long series of events.
Well, but, all right, but let's look at that for a second. Why do you think DARPA is having that contest? It's so they can get a vehicle that will operate itself.
Yes.
So they can do what with it? Take personnel on picnics? Answer, probably not.
The stated purpose
yes.
is to deliver medicines and supplies.
Yes.
So this is, you know, and to save people's lives. The example they give is a war-torn area that needs supplies desperately. We can't bring the supplies in because the area is so unstable. Days or weeks go by and people die.
Give me an example of an ethical judgment this vehicle might be required to make.
Okay. In a civilian setting,
mm-hmm.
it detects that its driver is impaired.
Oh, so it has a driver.
Well, we can assume that it could in a commercial, in a civilian
so
setting.
So it decides the driver is impaired with like a 0.2, God knows what, right? Totally.
Or something like that, yes.
Okay.
Inebriated, sleepy,
right,
busy
impaired.
Talking on his cell phone.
yes, and then once it decides we've got an out-of-control driver on our hands, what?
Okay, now, it can talk to the driver and tell it. Tell the driver, him or her.
Hey, bud, you seem a little impaired to me in here.
We're going to go off the next exit ramp, and we're going to call a cab. Or let me take over from here.
Oh.
Okay, that's an example. It's a little far off right now, but we're hoping to bring that into
reality. Boy, I'll tell you, if my car let loose on me like that.
You wouldn't like it much, huh?
It's incredible. So, but if necessary, it would grab control, seize control from the impaired driver.
Let's say the impaired driver is about to cause an accident.
This is excellent, yes.
The impaired driver is about to cause an accident which the computer calculates would harm or destroy people's lives.
That law of robotics immediately takes over, right?
And the car prevents the driver from causing the accident.
Stop stupid drivers in their tracks.
It takes enough control of the vehicle to prevent the accident from occurring.
Too good to be true.
Or in the event that the accident cannot be prevented, it will actually make choices to minimize the effects of the accident. For example, you're going to broadside a car.
Right.
You know, obviously the computer could calculate that would cause loss of life, and it might be able to turn or adjust the vehicle's attitude in some position where the broadside could be mitigated.
I do understand. All right. Would the vehicle, in your opinion, opt to protect its own passenger and that life above and beyond the life of the people it's about to broadside? How ethically would it make that choice?
That's an excellent question.
Well, since the guy owns it,
right,
since it's his artificial intelligence, why not have it opt ethically, or would that be unethical? I mean, you know, you could be headed toward a car full of little tiny kitties and puppies and stuff.
We actually have all of our people are on this particular committee. We have a ethics committee.
Oh, so these kinds of questions
are raised and
yes,
discussed.
Uh-huh.
What would happen if? Now, the way we currently have our ethics configured, it actually takes time to decide which humans might be more valuable. For example,
holy mackerel,
the ones that it is charged to protect are more valuable than the ones
than the drunken
than
bum that I'm carrying right now. How about that?
See, now there's a good question. Now, obviously we hope that it can always mitigate the accident in such a way that nobody's lives are in danger.
I'm sure that would be first on the list. But if it was thee or me...
We don't have that answer yet. We're working on it.
These are things that you're... Well, that's really something to even contemplate. That's really something. All right. Hold on. DARPA, hon.
Yeah. What is DARPA? Absolutely nothing.
Just weapons and food. Did I say weapons? Medicine and food, right? We'll be right back.
Find out more about tonight's guest. Log on to coasttocoastam.com. To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
You can just tell this is going to be fun. Ron Mad Max Fink is my guest, and we're discussing, and I had no idea we'd be talking about vehicles that would, well, maybe choose their own path and decide their own ethics and drive themselves if necessary, or perhaps if you'd like them to. Can you imagine the TV commercials we're going to get for this stuff? Holy mackerel, more in a moment. To be clear here, Ron is involved in a DARPA challenge, a grand challenge event of some sort for this vehicle, along with about how many other teams do you think, Ron?
Well, there were 106 teams.
There were 106.
Yes, and DARPA, because they were completely overwhelmed, I think they were expecting half a dozen or so.
Right.
Began trimming the field.
Okay, and how did they do that?
Well, a number of ways. The first one was with technical papers, and we survived that cut. It went from 106 to 45. And then they decided that they needed to cut the field more. They were going to allow 25 at the QID,
wow,
which is their qualification run.
Okay.
And so they decided to have site visits.
Oh.
And the site visits...
you mean DARPA inspectors? Or
yes.
Yes.
A team of four DARPA inspectors came to our place.
No kidding. Yeah. Now, that must have been unnerving.
It was... interesting, to say the least.
And what were they looking for and at?
Well, they were looking for how well we were financed, how far along we were, whether or not our architecture would work, whether or not we had working systems in place.
Right.
They did not want to send anybody to the QID with the limited number of slots that they could provide.
Gotcha.
Without having, without being certain that they could actually make it there.
Okay, serious stuff. And
yeah.
So...
No, we did not survive the last cut. I was informed today that we are not going to be in the DARPA challenge.
And what is it that keeps you from the Great Challenge?
We learned about the Great Challenge in September. And so our systems and our sponsors were not far enough along that they felt that we would actually be able to finish on March 6th. However, I did receive a phone call from somebody I am not allowed to identify inside of DARPA.
Oh, yes.
Which said that they thought our architecture, our software architecture, was the most robust and certainly the most powerful that of any of the 106 teams.
Well, that's... that's really something. So you could end up perhaps working with some other group they end up picking.
Well, a lot of people view this as, okay, the world is saved from DARPA having our technology. And some other people, you know, have different points of view.
How will you now proceed? I mean, you still may get, it, based on what they said then, you may get a call from them to be writing the software for somebody else's winning entry. I mean, who knows? So you can always imagine...
I think
imagine...
we'll burn that bridge when we come... I mean, sorry. Cross that bridge when we come to it.
Yes.
I think that where we really need to go now is what we did in the meantime. Because that actually constitutes a rule change from DARPA. They didn't do what they said they were going to do.
In what respect?
Well, we believed... based on the rules that were posted on their website and the rules that they were going to operate by, that anybody who could put in a technical paper that would be acceptable,
yes,
that would show that their scientists would say this could work,
yes,
would be allowed to enter the QID in March.
When, in fact, they wanted groups to be far more along than that stage. They wanted physical reality or what?
Well, in this case, no. They just had too many people, so they had to trim the field.
I understand, but I mean the qualifier then must have been some sort of physical reality, something beyond...
For example, we were still seeking our automobile sponsor when DARPA came to visit a couple of weeks ago.
And are you now still seeking your automobile sponsor?
Yes.
Tell me more. Let's talk more about the automobile. I mean, we would make choices.
Mm-hmm.
It would potentially even seize control from you, call a taxi for you. What other things would a really smart, I mean, they like to call today's cars smart, right? Smart cars.
They haven't got a clue.
They haven't got a clue. So a really smart car would do what else?
Well, a really smart car can recognize where it is by dead reckoning as well as through GPS. And
I want to stop you right there. Okay. Now, here's what I have always thought stopped us from being able to do a robotic car, and that is that there would have to be some sort of electronic signature or signal for it to follow literally down the road to keep it exactly on the road. Are you telling me that GPS and other technologies have come far enough to just use what we've got, and what we've got would be sometimes a dotted line, sometimes a line on the right, sometimes not.
Right.
And all kinds of intersections and a million things that can happen. Little kids running out in the middle of the street after balls, you know, you've seen all the films, right?
Yes.
So how can you take GPS and tell me what else and turn it into a drivable, you know, a reality?
Well, that's the point of the challenge. DARPA was unable to find any company anywhere that could build a truly autonomous vehicle, and that's why they started the challenge. And when the 106 teams got narrowed to 45 and then the 25, there were a whole lot of teams that were fielding new technology, people who in their garages had quit their jobs and poured their life savings into, into building this thing because they thought they could, that brought in all kinds of ideas and new thinking, out-of-the-box thinking.
Do you know much about the other teams?
Well, a little bit.
A little bit.
Let me tell you why.
Were you in touch with any of the other teams?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Yes. And the teams needed a venue. Many of them lost sponsors they had already gotten because DARPA had put them in the questionable status, the questionable category.
And that was the last straw for the sponsors.
Right.
Yeah, got it.
And so it was kind of a disaster for many of the smaller teams that were put into this marginal category. For example, there were a number of teams that were that were fielded by large, well-known technical universities, Caltech, Carnegie Mellon, and others, that were not put into the maybe status. The maybe status was primarily reserved for people who didn't have enough of a reputation that...
So you're telling me politics was part of it?
Yes, I think so.
Well,
to limit the field. They did have to make choices. And I have to respect DARPA for the thing that they started. But what we did is in November, when we saw this coming down the road.
See, Ron, you know what you should have done? On your model on paper,
mm-hmm.
You should have had a big damn gun on it. If you'd have had a big gun on it, Ron, you'd be in.
There you go.
Just a big monster gun.
Well, what we did instead was we started the International Robot Racing Federation.
Uh-huh.
And that event is happening in September of 2004. And so many of the teams that were applying and were dissed by DARPA are going to be in that race. And the race is going to be tougher and even more autonomous.
Can I ask you about something?
Yes.
I've got this little MPEG video that's one of the funnier damn things I ever saw in my whole life. And it shows two robots that are about to fight, right?
Okay.
And the one robot looks like it's about to get murdered by the other robot. And the other robot just stands there waiting to be slaughtered. At the last second, it opens its little doors, and there's this popular beer. Well, the other robot freaks out, grabs the beer. Robot one smashes the other robot into 50 million pieces. It's the funniest thing you ever saw. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
No, you haven't. I'll get your email address and send it to you, Ron.
I love it.
It's funny.
Okay.
All right. So have you done any of that kind of stuff? I know they actually have... You know, like cockfights, only they use robots.
Well, the robot wars I actually have been staying out of because I felt more like they were remote control wars. I didn't see anything autonomous about the ones that I saw.
True enough, but still, articulation and
yes,
killing ability, stuff like that really counts.
Still, with somebody standing in a nearby place with a joystick.
Well, yeah.
Yes.
So in your case, though, you could come up with an independent warrior, couldn't you?
I could.
Nobody has to stand anywhere with a joystick. It just goes and beats the hell out of the other.
That's true. We could go there, but we have chosen not to go there.
Imagine their fright when they realized you didn't even have a joystick. All you did was set yours loose.
All right. Well, the International Robot Racing Federation has what it calls the Open Challenge, and that's going to be in September. And it's not closed. It's open to everybody. I understand from some teams that they tried to apply for the DARPA race and weren't even accepted in the first place, more than the 106 teams, because they, for example, had team leaders who weren't U.S. citizens. And so that was a concern that DARPA had. And so those teams didn't get to play.
Hmm.
There's a lot of interest in Japan and Europe in the International Robot Racing Federation.
Well, the Japanese have a little bit of a lead on us robotically, don't they?
Well, they do. But, you know, we have that good old American ingenuity.
Can we circle back to my question? Now, I want to know how a vehicle would take GPS information and whatever else might be available to it and be good enough to stay on the road, avoiding hazards, operating safely in every way one can imagine. How is that technology integrated to keep a vehicle that close to the right place at the right time, at the right speed, blah, and all the rest of it?
Well, it needs better sensors than just GPS. GPS is just literally not good enough for this kind of thing.
Right.
So we've developed vision systems that are ultra-dense, ultra-high resolution, and ultra-fast.
Meaning it can see.
It can see. It can see in 360 degrees at all times.
In just what, normal vision or night vision or in spectral vision of some sort or what?
In normal vision and in infrared. And it uses the infrared also to help detect what kind of object it's looking at. For example, it can tell a very flat road from water.
So it can literally see more of a spectrum than the human eye?
Yes.
Okay.
And it can see it faster than the human eye can see it. And it can see it at about the same resolution. We're also integrating what some people call LIDAR.
What's LIDAR?
LIDAR is a scanning laser system that can pinpoint distances within a centimeter. And it's a backup system which actually verifies the stereo vision's perception of how far away something is. So humans can guess, well, you know, I think that's about 50 feet away. And in their mind, they have this mental image about how much longer they can go before they have to turn.
Gee, Ron, you know, it seems to me as though the work you're doing is more crucial to the operation of a potential autonomous vehicle than somebody who would have come up with the mechanical abilities to respond to the software orders you're capable of giving it. I mean, that just seems like almost kid's play compared to what you're doing.
I think so, yes.
Yeah, so do I.
That's why we need the, you know, the hugely parallel systems with
the... Well, then what the hell's the matter with DARPA? They should be looking at it the same way. A translation into mechanical reality is nothing compared to the ability to write the software to operate it.
Well, I believe they think that the teams that they picked are the best qualified.
Should have had a big gun, Ron. I'm telling you.
Should have had a big gun.
Yeah. Anyway, so then... What about all the normal other stuff in a car? Doors, windows, temperature control, I don't know, entertainment. In your car, for example, you could just, I assume, get in, tell it where to go, and then watch your favorite TV show or something?
Well, the last system I worked on actually was that sort of a system. It basically had a voice interface, and the entertainment systems, the telephone, and just about every other entertainment or communication system on the vehicle would respond to voice commands.
Ah.
And not only that, but the navigation system could actually tell you in a normal human voice, where you were, where you were going, you know, how to get there.
So you could
right
say something like
intersection.
You could say something like radio, coast to coast AM, please.
Yes. Exactly.
Oh, too cool. Oh my. You know, a lot of people I'm sure are wondering why this hasn't been done yet. I mean, these ideas really are good ideas. They really are.
They're being done.
Because we have, what, 50,000 plus people who are killed on the highways every year, right?
Yes.
Now, what would this do to that number?
Well, we're hoping to cut it by two-thirds.
Two-thirds?
Within 15 years.
Wow. You should be getting sponsorship from Chevrolet. Or Ford, something
we're
like that.
We're working on that. In fact, we're in discussions with Ford right now. They're hesitating right now because of the fact that we didn't get into the DARPA race. And so now we have to show them that the September race will be even better.
Actually, how long have you been working on the attempt to get into DARPA?
We learned about the DARPA race in September.
So this comes as crushing news, literally, just as you're about to go on the air, huh?
Yes.
Well, certainly.
Not crushing, because actually, to us, it's a project management situation, and in project management, the order of the day, if you're a good project manager, is to always handle the high-risk items first. And the moment that DARPA began changing the rules in order to narrow down the field,
Yes. We
realized that we were at risk. And also, there were a whole lot of other teams that realized that they were at risk. So we led the charge to form the International Robot Racing Federation. We have some marketing people on board. It's going to be a fabulous event in Nevada. It's going to be a 300-mile race.
Here in Nevada?
Yeah.
Oh. A 300-mile, now it's going to be a race.
Yes.
Is it that important for robots to have speed?
The speed shows that they're actually capable of reasoning at a rate that makes them a viable alternative. If they can't reason fast enough to handle a race, then they're not fast enough to go into the commercial
world. And what kind of venue would this race be conducted on? Certainly not the highways of Nevada. Or is it?
Well, we are negotiating with cities. Las Vegas is among them. And we are going to begin and end in Las Vegas, probably.
Oh.
And we are negotiating for, you know, the right road blockages and you know, the police and so forth like that.
Don't you think the authorities would be concerned? Well, sure, you know, just send this robot troop down Interstate 15.
We have...
Isn't that going to be hard to get permission for?
There's a device that's known in the industry as an e-stop box. It's basically a black box that you have to hook into your vehicle.
Yes.
And you don't have control over the black box. The people who are hosting the event have control over the black box.
Right.
And if you go out of range or out of line of sight,
yes.
Or if your vehicle misbehaves in
yes.
any way,
yes.
that is outside the rules.
Becomes pristine-like at all.
Right.
Yes.
Then it is immediately shut down. And in the qualification runs, the black box concept is tested in a variety of ways to make sure that no matter what happens, that vehicle will shut down in a safe manner. And if it does not shut down in a safe manner, it isn't allowed into the race.
Huh. Well, wouldn't the prospect of somebody... who's unaware of the race, for example, I mean, looking over at one of the robots and seeing a car with no driver, now that's going to cause societal problems right there. Right?
It would.
Would for me if I looked over and, good Lord, there's no one in there.
The intent is not to have it anywhere near regular drivers.
Ah, so you'd have to have cleared roads
and
a clear path.
And it's not going to be just roads. A lot of it, most of it, in fact, is going to be off-road.
Really?
Because that's where the true obstacles are. That's where you're going to find the down trees, the water hazards, the ruts, the rocks.
Oh, yes.
You know, the barbed wire fences.
Well, I can't. So these robots, then, are going to be all-terrain kind of bots.
They're going to be driving typically a four-wheel drive vehicle or a one of those little quads.
Oh.
What do they call this?
That sounds like it's going to be so much fun.
It's going to be a blast.
Ron, Mad Max Fink, hold on. We'll get right back to you. Yeah. Oh, that sounds like it'd be fun to watch, doesn't it? Cutting through the countryside, destroying everything in its path. It's Autobot.
You dudes, get back to my back. I love you. You dudes, sweet young men. When you see me in the week, you got the teeth of the hide upon you. You dudes, sweet young men.
Hit the red button, Ron, and let's rock.
Get it on.
To talk with Art Bell, call the wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It certainly is. And I just tried to send that MPEG to Ron, who'd really get a kick out of it, and my ISP rejected it as spam. It thinks it's spam, you see? It's a robot that is not that intelligent because it's not spam. It happens to be very funny, but the ISP thinks it's spam. Filtering for me. That's what robots can do for you. We'll get back to Ron Mad Max Fink in a moment. Stay right there.
All right. Well, I'm trying to send it again here, Ron. So maybe, I don't know. It rejected. It was like, no, it rejected it again. It took the almost whole thing, then said rejected because it thinks it's spam. So there is an example of a stupid program. Not or misunderstanding what it's got hold of somehow or another, somewhere along the line. Might not be my ISP. It might be, you know, the master ISP or something else along the line. But it's deciding it's spam, which it's not. And so translate that to your business. And in making these decisions, I mean, look at what just happened to me. If you're in a car and you've got a car making decisions for you, have we really advanced far enough to really have that a car being able to make decisions for you?
Not yet. We're getting there. That's what the purpose of the challenge is for. The concept is that when...
Hold on. I'm losing your volume a little. Let me try and reset this. All right.
You're gonna have
this. I think that's better. Get good and close to that phone.
I am. Yes.
Right on to it. All right.
I think it's now... permanently ensconced somewhere in my mouth.
All right. All right. anyway, actually what I want to do is go back to the, you know, the all-terrain thing. That really, actually that sounds like an awful lot of fun, particularly here in Nevada, where we've got, if you saw that flying saucer picture I had up there, that kind of territory. So it would have to make an awful lot of decisions along the way.
That's right.
That sounds like an awful lot of fun.
We have a subsystem that is an obstacle computer system. And it looks at all the data and decides what obstacles are there, whether or not they're part of the landscape or whether or not they're capable of movement, whether or not they're animal or human, and, you know, just what kind of obstacle they are and, therefore, what behaviors that kind of obstacle has.
Right.
And the obstacle computer has a very advanced learning algorithm built into it. So when it gains experience with a certain kind of obstacle, it now recognizes that obstacle better. And it recognizes how it will behave better. And so it can actually anticipate the behavior of other objects so that it can make plans ahead of time about how to avoid the obstacle.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, it knows for how humans behave, and it knows how certain kinds of animals behave. It knows how rocks don't behave. It understands concepts of trees and bushes and brush. It knows about barbed wire fences and chain link fences. It knows about water and how to tell how deep the water is. And with these kinds of skills, it knows in advance what kind of actions it can take with relation to the other vehicle. For example, in the racing situation, the water navigation rules apply in most cases because you're in an open area, not on roads.
Right.
So, for example, the water navigation rules specify how you can overtake a boat.
It's going to be very important for you to understand where this race is going to be, because if it's going to be, for example, in the Nevada desert, it's kind of like the surface of Mars out here. Mm-hmm. You're not going to encounter necessarily a lot of water unless they plan it that way, but you're certainly going to encounter a lot of desert hazards.
Yes.
So you'd want to kind of lay your design heavily into that area.
In fact, we do.
Uh-huh.
I actually live here in Las Vegas on Sunrise Mountain.
So you fully understand what it's like here, then.
And 3 blocks from me is some really rugged mountain desert.
Yep.
And that's where we test.
Ah, the perfect test ground.
Yes.
And so you're actually to that testing stage.
We're testing subsystems mounted on our own vehicles at this point.
You're using your own vehicles?
Yes. So we're mounting camera arrays and driving them and analyzing the results. And we're running that camera array into the decision process of the computer system.
Wow.
And having the computer system make choices. And the more data we can feed it, the faster it learns.
Have you told your insurance company you're doing this?
No? The insurance company said that we can't. Oh. They won't insure us if we enter one of the vehicles in a race.
Oh, what a surprise. But, I mean, what about testing?
You know, they didn't say anything.
They didn't
about
mention
that.
Anything about the testing phase, huh?
So we'll see what they say now that they're going to hear this radio show.
Well, yeah,
if I get a call tomorrow, we'll know.
That's right. I'm sorry if you do.
Whether or not the insurance company listens to Art Bell. Maybe at that point we'll have to seek an insurance company sponsor for the race.
Yes. Yes. Okay. I'm going to presume then that you're covered until you get that worrisome call.
That's correct.
Interesting. And so you're using your own car. What kind of cars are you using?
Well, I used my ex-wife's Suburban.
Ex-wife's cars are good to use.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
And actually, we have an old 57 Pontiac.
Uh-huh.
That has grill work that looks a lot like Christine.
Yeah. And so
we also have 3 dune buggies.
Three dune buggies.
Various stages of...
All right, so what these cameras are taking in, whatever they're taking in, and making what kind of decisions at the level you're at now?
They are discerning the distance of everything.
Okay.
And they're turning that into an XYZ point field.
Right.
And then the point field also has an RGB and a T associated with it, and that's the color spectrum and the temperature. now it knows the temperature, the color, and the exact XYZ position of every point, every pixel in the array. And the array is very dense. Now it takes this point field and it analyzes it based on a number of factors, and it turns it into a terrain map, which it compares with terrain data in its database. And now from that, it knows its exact position and its orientation or attitude and its vector. In other words, which directions it's traveling.
Wow.
And also its rotational vectors. For example, if the vehicle is going in a straight line, but it's rotating around the yaw axis, you know that it doesn't have control of itself and it needs to be brought back into control.
What does it do, by the way, if it decides it's out of control?
Well, it has control over the direct control over the ABS systems and over the air-fuel mixtures of the vehicle. It interfaces directly with the vehicle's computer and or with its electronics. And so, or in the case of the dune buggies, with electromechanical things that control the brake, gas, and the shift levers. And so, it decides which wheel to apply braking power to and which vehicle to apply a little bit more power to, and it handles that.
Now, how are you guys testing? I mean, is there somebody at the wheel, you know, like keeping his hand off the wheel and off everything else until somebody else says, hey, grab the wheel?
Right now, every one of our tests has somebody behind the wheel.
Uh-huh.
So we're not yet to the point, and that's probably one of the reasons why DARPA was unsure whether we could make the March deadline.
And is your software to the point now where the guy behind the wheel is so relaxed that he's given it up and he's laying in the back seat taking a nap?
We're not at that point yet.
Not yet.
We are supposed to be, according to the project plan, at that point on February 14th.
And there was, do you agree with DARPA that there's no way you could have made that point by that date?
No, I don't agree with DARPA on that.
Oh, you don't?
No. I'm one of the reasons they call me Mad Max.
Yes?
I take on impossible projects and I bring them in on time.
You could have done it.
Yes.
Stupid DARPA. Should have had the gun. All right, well, so are you going to go ahead and do it anyway?
Yes, we are, because we have to do it anyway for the IRRF race, which we think will be a better event anyway. It's far more media-friendly.
What is that?
The IRRF race?
Yes, yes.
That's the International Robot Racing Federation.
Sorry, I'm not up on this stuff.
It's okay.
The International Robot Racing Federation.
And that's at IRRF.org.
Okay.
If anybody wants to learn more.
I'm sure they will.
And it's new because we just spearheaded getting that formed after Thanksgiving. So it's a work in process, but its concept and its mission is to achieve breakthrough technology through grand contests, grand competitions.
Huh.
And the reason that we say that is because in the technology world today, corporations take little tiny baby steps with risk. They want to be real sure that they can easily accomplish the programming or technology and that they have a ready market for it. And so anything that's far out tends to stay far out until enough of a groundswell or preparation, or if you will, a bed of technology builds up around it that the thing becomes an easy thing.
All I'm curious, Ron, do you know offhand what large companies like Ford and Chevrolet, they sponsor people, I understand, like you,
mm-hmm.
but are they in their own research labs going down these roads, do you think, themselves? Or what
they
do you
would get there eventually, but eventually could be 5 or 10 or even 20 years.
But they're not actively working on it now, do you know?
On an autonomous vehicle, I don't think so. And the reason would be is because it's too far out. And that's, I think, the genius behind DARPA's decision to turn this into a contest.
Answer really is, it's not too far out.
No.
No.
People who are out there.
Honestly, it makes sense to me, Ron. It doesn't seem like it ought to be that far out. we have all kinds of sensing technology. We have geniuses like you at writing software, and that's all it is a chain of decisions, right?
Yes, it can be viewed that way. This, however, probably is orders of magnitude, I think, over
beyond. Yeah, I simplified it. I understand that. But still, it's an artifact or an ability of artificial intelligence. It's a long, hard road, but one that we might be at the door of right now, not
I believe we are, yeah.
10 years from now.
I believe left to itself, the market would get around to it in 10 or 20 years. I think that the mere fact that we are turning this kind of really advanced technology, way out there stuff, into entertainment means that the people who want to do this kind of stuff have a venue that they can finance their work with. For example, can you imagine going to a venture capitalist and you're a garage guy and you say, well, you know, with a few $100,000, I think I can build this autonomous vehicle.
Yeah.
And the venture capitalist goes, uh-huh. and he knows that there's been $2 billion spent on it by DARPA so far and that they've pretty much come up empty-handed. And they know that the best thing that they've seen so far is, you know, magnetic line followers or something like that. And you're trying to tell me that you can build an autonomous vehicle where everybody else
right.
has failed so far. And so they're not going to take that kind of risk. So by turning this into entertainment and by building a venue where really out there technology projects that are high-risk projects can be paid for because of their entertainment value and their competition value, then what we are doing, and this is not the only race, not the only venue, then we're creating a whole environment that can advance the world's technology at a far more rapid rate than the corporate...
would save a lot of lives, too.
Yes.
I mean, a lot of lives. Two-thirds of that 50,000 plus that are killed on our highways.
I have a personal story with regard to that.
Yes.
If you got time.
I do.
I have a nephew who died a couple of years ago in 2001 in a tragic accident with a piece of large industrial a tractor, basically.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And he was crushed to death, and it was horrible. And it could have been avoided, but you know, there was time pressures and things like that. And with our technology on board, that accident could not have happened. It would not have been a possible thing. The computer would not have allowed the tractor to do whatever it did that killed my nephew.
Well, that's a strong motivation for you.
Yes, it is. And so when the opportunity came in September, we were all over it. But now, even more so, with the new International Robot Racing Federation advancing technology by leaps and bounds through its entertainment and competition value, we expect not only to do that for autonomous vehicles and keep advancing autonomous vehicles,
mm-hmm.
but for many other things as well.
Well, it's an admirable thing you're doing. Just tell me as much about it as you can, what you expect to have when you have your finished product, when you have the finished product in your hands. And it's not that far away, is it? You've got to do it pretty quick.
Yes. I'm used to doing things very quickly.
Are you?
Yes.
Okay, so will your vehicle do all you said you described, or what part of it will it do? Or
we're expecting all of those capabilities to be online for the race. We expect to be able to fully recognize our terrain, be able to understand the objects that we're encountering and what they do, and to be able to give those objects values in terms of whether or not we can are allowed to destroy them or harm them or come near them, but also to understand what behaviors that they will have and anticipate, have, you know, plan B, plan C, and plan D already online in case the object does something unexpected.
What are the chances of that?
We intend to make the course challenging enough that that there's a chance that nobody could win.
That nobody could win?
That's right. See, DARPA's putting up $1 million for a challenge that they fully expect that maybe nobody will be able to complete.
What kind of obstacles do you imagine and then obviously try to plan for in your programming that might be so impossible?
Well, we know that DARPA is planning to make us go along railroad sidings and be able to navigate those ourselves.
Hmm.
We know that they are going to put us through freeway underpasses, those little underpasses where the washes and the animals can cross the freeway and so forth.
Sure.
And they know that that they have planned several areas where GPS is not available because they want to see how the vehicles handle it when the GPS is not available.
Oh.
And they are not giving the actual waypoints of the course.
You mean, for example, you send it into a tunnel where GPS couldn't get?
Or in a canyon, a narrow canyon. And so there will be lots of places where GPS will be dead. There are places where we have to navigate roads. And the roads may or may not have lanes, for example, but we still have to stay in the lane. And we have to do that by recognizing where the right edge of the road is, you know?
Well, that's asking a lot, particularly being out of GPS range. This is really something. Okay, well, robots, and they're getting ready for one that they're going to put in a race. Eventually, what DARPA wants is an autonomous vehicle. What they want it for, I guess we'll have to leave to your imagination. From the high desert, you're listening to Coast AM roaring itself through a dark Sunday night, Monday morning. I'm Art Bell.
What to my surprise, a little Nash Rambler was following me about one third my size. The guy must have wanted to pass me out as he kept on tooting his horn. I'll show him that a Cadillac is not a car to scorn. Beep, beep. Beep, beep.
To talk with Art Bell, call the wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Indeed. And I'm sorry, I couldn't resist.
My car went into passing gear and we took off with Gus. Soon we were doing 90, must have left him in the dust. When I peeked in the mirror of my car, I couldn't believe my eyes. The little Nash Rambler was right behind. I think that guy could fly. Beep, 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 beep. His horn went beep, beep, beep. Now we're doing 110. This certainly was a race.
for Rambler to pass a caddy would be a big disgrace. The guy must have wanted to pass Miata, he kept on tooting his horn. I'll show him that a Cadillac is not a car to scorn. Beep, 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 his horn went beep, beep, beep. Now we're doing 120 as fast as I could go. The Rambler pulled alongside of me as if we're going slow. The fella rolled down his window and yelled for me to hear, "Hey buddy, how can I get this car out of second gear?"
Well, all right, here's the thing, Ron. Most of the time, my wife and I drive a little Geo Metro around town. You know, it gets great gas mileage, just a little car, and it's just a great little car, and that's what we drive. But I must tell you, Ron, I have in my garage my Firebird Trans Am. See, so every now and then, Ron, I take it out and have fun. You know what I mean? We, you know, we hit one of the highways around here. I mean, we're both living here in Nevada, same state. You know what the highways, I mean, you can get out on, you know, like way out up north on 95 or one of these back roads, well-maintained, and you can pour it on a little, Ron, and have fun. Now, it seems like a vehicle of the sort you've described would hate people wanting to have fun.
I completely disagree.
You do?
Yes.
And just
why would it hate people having fun?
Well, because I'm not saying it's exactly well, yes, it is. Because some fun is inherently dangerous. I mean, seeing if you can do 130 miles an hour is fun on the one hand, but potentially and possibly dangerous, certainly on the other.
Well, that's why we need something that can process at racing speeds. Because it can understand whether or not you're in control. And, in fact, help you stay in control if you hit that curve.
Well, help me to understand how, I mean, in most ways of thinking, if you're doing even 120, even 100, you would think the logic would say this is inherently unsafe. No?
It would definitely know whether or not you could handle that corner at 120 and decide whether or not to let the car continue. You always have the option, I'm sure, of disengaging it since you own the car. But in our case, we don't equate a speed limit as a limit of safety.
Oh.
So
well, that's
we're
interesting.
Not,
that's interesting.
We're not, our job is not to enforce
the law. You're not
the
speed police. All right, for you.
Okay. Our job is just to keep the vehicle and its passengers safe.
I like it.
So if it's safe to go 135 or 165, then I don't see any reason why not.
Well,
I have some toys, too. I had to sell them to finance this project, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But I intend to buy a few toys back when we're done.
Well, it's your dream.
Yeah.
You've got to pursue your dream, and that's how people make millions, Ron. There's no question about it. You do something like this, and boom, the world opens for you. Sometimes.
We've already had to develop three technologies that we have patents pending on just to enter the race.
Yeah, can you talk about them?
Well, very briefly.
Okay.
We have a new mapping technology.
Right.
You may be familiar with airplanes that fly over an area and they do altitude LIDAR scans.
Sure.
We can do that with 1,000 times the resolution.
Oh.
And not only that, but when that plane lands, it has a bunch of data that it has to convert into XYZ point data. And the post-processing can take weeks or months. We can do it in real time so that when the plane lands, it has 1,000 times the resolution, and it has it right now. So that's a technology that we've developed, and we're applying for the patents, and we are in negotiations with an entire country in Africa to actually map that country for them.
Really?
Yes. I can't say the name. And I can't
That's all right. Wouldn't your concept have some kind of application, perhaps, to, for example, NASA. Now, they're about to land these robots on Mars.
Yes.
And it seems to me a lot of what you're talking about would be integrated or could be integrated in one of those vehicles.
We are planning to propose that. We're also in contact with JPL and Caltech about actually running a scan in relation to something else that they're doing. And I'm not at liberty to say. But
ooh, you're involved in quite a few
if that
gray,
happens,
gray things, aren't you?
Well, I don't think this is gray. It's just that it's just that when you're in negotiations with somebody,
yeah,
you don't want to tell the world as if it's an accomplished thing.
True enough.
So it's not necessarily gray, but these people are very interested in testing our technology to see if it works.
But you can't tell me the name of the guy who called you back from DARPA.
I can't.
You know,
that was not an authorized phone call.
I've got it. I really have this feeling that you're going to be getting a knock on your door, and it's going to be somebody from some kind of agency who's going to be very interested in, you know, you got an awful lot laid out for an autonomous vehicle there, software-wise. So,
yes, we do.
So you just might be working for our government. So.
Well, we hope to market our technology in a number of very helpful ways. And we view this as a great way to showcase what we can do, but we also view it as a great way to showcase what the other teams can do as well. So for the IRRF, the Open Challenge, there is a committee that actually will do all of the race setup without my involvement so that there's no advantage to the home team, so to speak.
Hmm.
And we're going to run the race along with everybody else. But there is some cooperation that's happening among the teams.
You're not allowed to have your vehicle in any way sabotage that of another team.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
Part of the rules, and also in DARPA's rules, by the way.
Ah.
We're not to interfere with the other vehicles. When we pass them, we have to pass them safely. The responsibility for the safety is on the passing vehicle, not on the vehicle being passed. The QID, of course, the e-stop has to be in effective. And there'll be a number of challenges at the QID itself with qualification runs in the case of the open challenge that will decide whether or not the vehicle actually is autonomous and can run the course.
I wonder how they actually measure that. I mean, is DARPA going to have teams out there following these individual vehicles, documenting their performance?
Yes, actually. They're doing this in cooperation with SCORE, which is the Southern California Off-Road Racing Enthusiasts. It's I don't even know if I got the acronym right, but it's a very venerable and respected off-road vehicle association, and they do a lot of, they're involved in a lot of off-road events, and they have a lot of experience. And those people, SCORE is setting up chase vehicles that will be manned by one SCORE person and one person from DARPA, and they will stay within range of their particular subject vehicle, and if the vehicle gets out of range, then the e-stop will go into effect and stop the vehicle until they can catch up.
And I hope they race them through Pahrump.
That would be fun.
Well, we'd be a good area for that out here.
DARPA's not going to do that, but we are actually in negotiations with a number of cities surrounding Las Vegas to see if they will allow us to do that.
Pahrump would be a natural.
Pahrump is one of them.
You betcha. Here we are.
And we're definitely in the, we are definitely going to approach them as one of the cities.
Why not?
Now, because I'm also fielding an entry, I'm actually not one of the people that will know the route before it happens. The route will remain a secret.
That's right. That wouldn't be fair, would it?
So I won't know until everybody else knows exactly what the route is.
Mm.
But there will be things that people know. For example, we may know beforehand that it goes from Las Vegas to Pahrump to somewhere else and back to Las Vegas.
Fascinating. And how many do you think will be involved in the race itself? How many teams?
The IRRF, or, I'm sorry, yes. The Open Challenge or the DARPA Challenge?
Well, either one of, well, how about the other one, not DARPA, the Open
okay.
Challenge?
The Open Challenge, we're expecting around 80 teams to try out. And we're going to have numerous events along the way, early qualification runs, if you will, and they'll all be media events. And very sponsor friendly.
Oh, I would imagine so. I mean, the entertainment value of that alone, mm-hmm. pretty serious.
Yes. And then we're also talking the rules. We're probably going to let a vehicle that goes out of bounds, once it's stopped, and if they want to continue, they can continue. They would not be able to be eligible for the prize, but they would still be able to finish the race.
Huh.
And that decision was made because of its sponsor value. And because of the learning value to the team.
And the sponsor value, entertainment value equals lots of things,
yes.
right?
Well, it's what makes this all possible.
Well, of course. Big audience, sponsorship, and so away you go. There's money.
Now, the IRRF is also going to have a Robot City in conjunction with the race itself.
And that will be what?
It'll be a four-day-long event that can be translated not only into a big entertainment event, but a chance for the teams to showcase their technology and a place where people interested in talking to teams about purchasing their technology can go. It will be like a giant trade show and entertainment. It's Robot City. We're expecting 40 to 60,000 people.
My goodness. All right, let's talk for a second about artificial intelligence. How far do you think we are, Ron? I'm hidden away, as are most people, from, you know, people like yourself that are doing work in AI. How good is it getting? How serious is the work being done in AI? When do you think we actually might have a sentient is an awfully strong word.
Yes, it's a very strong
word. Very strong word, so I better not use that. Let's see. What would be the right word to measure what I'm trying to say other than sentient? Autonomous, I guess, is as good a word as any. Something that becomes autonomous because it is got such a quite or such a measure of sentience. I don't know. How do you measure these things? I really don't know.
I personally set up 16 capabilities that I thought defined sentience.
Really?
That worked together to provide sentience. And starting in the 70s when I first became obsessed with artificial intelligence,
yes,
I decided to do some of those 16 capabilities.
Can you reel a few of them off?
I can reel a few of them off,
well,
yeah.
Please do. I'm curious. Components in a sentient being, perhaps.
Well, let me just reel off a few of the interesting ones that I think you'd be surprised at.
Sure.
I am not going to talk about them all.
Okay.
One would be the ability to sleep and dream.
Really?
For example, in the 70s, I developed an algorithm, or series of algorithms, that allow the computer to go into a dreamlike state when it is not using all its cycles. And it would use the spare cycles to do random associations and then test the associations for patterns that match.
Wait, this is so interesting. A computer that would, in its spare time, be allowed to simply freely associate, in essence,
yes.
do random associations and then test them.
Yes, for matching patterns. And then remember those patterns in a separate database so that when it's awake and it's called on to do creative things,
yes.
it can go to the associations it made in its dream state.
And use those in its yes. computational power.
Yes.
Wow.
And examine them for possible new solutions.
Gotcha.
And so by doing that, we feel that we've cracked one of the essential ingredients for actual machine creativity.
The necessity of dreaming, that's really pretty cool, Ron.
I thought so.
Yeah, I do too. I've right on. It sounds like there's parts of this you don't want to or can't talk about.
Right.
What are those parts?
Trying to slide it by me. Well, actually, we don't want to achieve sentience until we are absolutely certain that our ethics components work
right.
in all settings
right.
and cannot be corrupted.
Oh.
See, I don't want anybody to have to go back in time and kill my mother or anything like that, you know.
Well, yes.
We want this to be a safe and synergistic relationship if it ever happens.
You're telling me there are dangers, then, maybe even big ones, in sentience?
Well, imagine a machine that can process faster than humans.
That's by the way,
that not, can reproduce itself better.
Yeah, that's not getting too far from reality right now.
Well, right now it's actually still quite far from reality.
Is
thankfully.
It? Is it?
Yes. For some people, further than others. And I don't...
Well...
But we don't want to achieve sentience, literally, until we have the ethics.
Well, that's what I say. You perceive, then, a danger in sentience prior to being really sure about the ethics part
yes.
of it. Why do you imagine such a stopper? Why do you think sentience without direction would be dangerous? And how do you imagine it might be dangerous, for example?
Well, it's dangerous even in humans. If you damage the prefrontal lobe of a human or some other accident of birth or whatever damages the prefrontal lobe, then he loses that seat of ethics and care about other people. And now losing that, he can slide into a number of aberrations which are dangerous to the rest of humanity.
Right.
And that's been proven time and time again. Serial murderers, serial rapists, serial people who capture people and torture them to death, and even people who eat people.
Yeah.
So, sentience is a thing that has to be governed by ethics. It just has to.
So, like Moses, you've got to hand this thing the tablets before you set it loose.
Yes, so to speak, yes. So I don't want to create a sentient machine unless I'm absolutely certain that no matter how far it evolves, it will keep its ethics.
Somebody, Matthew in Memphis, wrote, here's the three laws, paraphrased. One, a robot cannot harm a human or allow one to be harmed. Two, a robot must obey all orders a human gives it unless it breaks law one.
Mm-hmm.
Three, a robot must protect itself unless this breaks law one or two.
Yes.
And that's about it. So in other words, all the laws given are ones that reflect back to human beings. So he must have been very concerned with that one thing.
And I can understand completely why he was.
Apparently you can, because you sound concerned. I don't know if I should use the word frightened, not frightened, by sentience, short of having the compassion. Oh, hold on, Ron. We'll be right back. Ron Mad Max Fink is my guest. We're talking robotics, and, oh, we really are. This is fun. We'll get to the phones in the next hour. Good evening. Good morning. I'm Art Bell.
The official website of Coast to Coast AM is www.coasttocoastam.com. Log on now.
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
And who would have thought that one conduit to a sentient being would be the ability to dream? That one knocked me off my feet a little bit. Ron Mad Max Finch is my guest, and you're about to have an opportunity to ask him questions about any of this. You know, sentience for a robot, and that's a road we still have to do a little traveling on our own here. Or the race, or the vehicles he's building, or what he's doing, or his dream. This is pretty wild stuff. Stay right where you are. I want to remind this group one more time. All of you now, listen to me very carefully. On the 28th and the 31st of this month, that's right, last day of the year, we get to bring in the new year, as we traditionally have with your predictions. Now, I want to stress this one more time because I want a good hit rate this year. So that means that to make your prediction, you just don't grab it out of the air, yank it out of the air and make it. I want you to sit in a comfortable, quiet place. Let your mind wander into blank areas and try to pluck a prediction for the year 2004 from it that's going to be on the mark. And that's really your best bet for doing this and for us to get a good group of hits for next year. So I'm going to be depending on you now, and I really mean that. Take a moment out, just set aside a little time in your life to go through the process and try to imagine a major event that's going to occur next year. We'll be taking those predictions, and I expect nothing but hits. All right, let's rock. First time caller line, you are on the air with Ron Mad Max Fink.
Hi, Ron. Hi, Art.
Hi.
Well, you guys have been talking about off-roading and 135 miles an hour. I've been up with my baby who's got a cold, and I'm out of cold medicine. And what I'd like is a prediction from Ron. How far away are we from the time when I could get on my computer, dial into Walmart, order what I want, and send my car to get it for me?
Ooh, very excellent question.
I love that question.
Superb question. All right, so she never has to leave her home. She zips over to Walmart electronically, makes the order, dispatches her car to go get something, and come back.
Well, without the racing and competition venue, I put that at 15 to 20 years away, at least. I think with the venue, I think we'll have it in under 10 years.
Wow. All right, so the racing is very important. All right, for a moment, back to the questions on sentience. I loved your answer. Dreaming. You would allow your processors to dream.
Yes.
Now, what other avenue or road towards sentience might there be that we could hear about? Ron?
Okay.
Well, it sounds, you had to think about that really hard, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, because...
Are you thinking about whether you what it is, or are you thinking about whether you really want to talk about it?
Yeah, whether I want to talk about it.
Ah, well, come on, whisper
because
it
Because I don't
ear.
Have the, you know, the ethics aren't in place yet. And I'd rather not see this get developed ahead of schedule,
yeah,
so to speak.
Yeah.
But we can talk about the ability to... see patterns that are not identical. For example, a lot of people say, there's a popular saying that says the history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes.
Huh.
And a sentient being, like a human being, understands when it examines it that this was similar to that, even though the dates are different and the facts are different. that it's the same sort of things that are associated with that event, the same, maybe the same kinds of human emotions, or the same kinds of reactions to poverty, or whatever else. And so humans look at that and say, there's a pattern here.
Right.
Okay. Now, a computer has to be able to recognize those patterns in things that are esoteric or high level.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I can see that. Pattern recognition.
Mm-hmm.
A very a subtler pattern recognition.
Right. For example, I mean, we can even look at it at different levels.
Well, what is it? What is it about this that makes you hesitant to discuss it ahead of the ethics quandary?
Well, I just looked at the other 16 in my head and said, which one of these can I say that's safe? And this was the one I could say that was safe.
Why are the others not safe to say? Is it because
I believe
you
that,
might your competitors might get this?
Well, I just believe that most people have their own concepts about what it would take for sentience to occur.
Yes.
Or maybe they believe that sentience is not possible in a machine. And for now, I think I would just as soon leave it that way.
I think it is possible. What about you?
I do believe it's possible.
It is a little scary in some respects, certainly.
It
really is a little scary.
I respect the power of sentience. And look, it's put us at the top of the food chain, on our planet at least. And frankly, that's not a post I want to.
All right. How, just though, for fun of it, how would you get past the Forbin Project syndrome? Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
Okay, the Forbin Project was a book and a movie about the United States and Russia both turning over their defensive and offensive capabilities to computers. And the Forbin Project computer on our side, of course, got out of control, and it decided, for example, and here's the real problem, Ron, that what human beings were doing, we're just going to wander a little here, was so ultimately suicidal for them from a population point of view, from a ecological point of view, bearing in mind we need the oxygen and the atmosphere and all that's the filtered sunlight and all the rest of that, that what we were doing was so ultimately suicidal that for our own good, going back to the first rule of robotics,
mm-hmm.
it made decisions that were expedient and deadly for many.
Yeah.
And all living according to it within the first law of robotics.
I am a great believer in free choice. I believe that people cannot progress without the ability to choose. And I am completely against any kind of machine limiting that choice. So, from a personal point of view, it would be a cold day in the in the hot regions before I ever wrote a line of code that would allow a computer to put to limit a person's freedom and freedom of choice.
All right then. Hard question, Ron.
Okay.
How would a robot respond to its owner beginning and obviously progressing with the act of suicide?
I think the robot would have to allow that.
Oh.
Now that's a tough one, isn't it? See?
I intended it to be.
Mm-hmm. And that is a good one. That's a very good question to ponder. And you can bet we'll be talking about this after this discussion is over.
Put it on your list. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Ron Mad Max Fink.
Good evening, Arch.
Good evening.
Ron.
Yes.
The capabilities of your automatic or atomic vehicles. For example, if you had a human driver, mid-age 40 to 50s, and he suffers, say, such a heart attack, a massive heart attack.
As sadly Brett Favre's father just appears to have, by the way.
Yes.
Late-breaking news, and the car, of course, crashed and ran off the roadway.
Exactly. Would your atomic vehicles be able to read the fact that a human was suffering a severe medical condition,
right,
be able to gain control of the vehicle, notify, say, like OnStar, which is, yeah, seems to be the GPS,
sure,
major thing, and notify that it's having this type of emergency situation, drive the vehicle to the hospital?
All right. Well, all superb questions, and I think the answers are yes. That's pretty much what you described at the beginning of the program, isn't it, Ron?
Yes, that's exactly right. It doesn't actually do it by monitoring any kind of pulse or anything like that.
I was just going to ask that.
It does it by recognizing whether or not he's in control of the vehicle.
In other
whether
words,
his driving patterns. See, it learns, and so it knows what your normal driving patterns are. And if that changes abruptly, then it can detect that there's a problem that way. And so it can take control of the vehicle,
all right,
and
I've,
know that...
All right, right, I've got it. But suppose, Ron, that you were in a situation where not all cars were so endowed, we'll put it that way, and you met with a real stupid idiot on the road, and you had to make some emergency evasive maneuver that to your vehicle, if it was only watching you for erratic behavior, might regard that emergency whatever, you know, spinning the car, turning it around, doing some weird thing to avoid a crash. It might regard that as not operating the vehicle properly and not allow it.
Not actually. It would probably have already anticipated that necessity.
Uh-huh. So would it judge you in your performance of evasion, or would it at that point take over knowing a human couldn't react quick enough to properly evade and make all the fast decisions for least loss of human life first?
If the human wasn't reacting fast enough, it would take over. So... Huh. The only thing that I can draw on is that when I was 16 and 17, I had a situation. I had to leave home early. And consequently, my parent was not amenable to allowing me to have a driver's license. And so in order to get a driver's license, I had to take a driving course, which annoyed me because I believed that I knew how to drive. So instead of just taking a standard driving course, I took a acrobatic driving course. And I learned how to put the car into various kinds of spins and to drive on two wheels.
Do you think all of that got you started down this path somehow?
It could have. But later on in my life, I actually saved somebody's life when they pulled out in front of me in 1975 across three lanes, saw me too close to avoid hitting them, and slammed on their brakes because they got frightened. Entirely the wrong thing.
Yeah.
And so I was driving a very heavy 1973 Chevrolet Caprice with bias ply tires. There was no way I could avoid hitting the driver right in the driver door.
Yeah.
Without some very fast action. And so because of the instincts that I developed with the acrobatic driving course, I threw the car into a sideways spin so that I was facing the direction that that car was facing. And just as I was about to hit the car, I gunned the engine, and spun the car so that it spun 180 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened is, the center of gravity of my car went through his car. But because of the spin, no part of my car touched his car.
Now, I take it that once all vehicles, virtually all vehicles, were autonomous,
mm-hmm,
that these sorts of things and accident avoidance wouldn't really generally be a problem because they'd all be reacting and would they interact with each other? Now, there's a good one for you. In other words, wouldn't it be possible, for example, for vehicles within a certain small radio radius to be in contact with each other?
Right. Same thing right now with laptop computers in 802.11.
That's right. It'd be another layered piece of protection if all the other cars around you vehicles were in connection with each other. The likelihood then of an accident goes down by another factor of 1,000 or something.
As you say, the transition period where not all cars have any kind of this kind of technology
right.
is the period where the most dramatic kind of things will occur. When everybody has it and the cars actually talk to each other, then there's no problem.
But as this continues, aren't the insurance companies going to suffer horribly?
Well, I don't know. I think they kind of like it when people don't get into accidents.
Do you think that?
Yeah.
When I said suffer horribly, I meant insurance rates will have to plummet. I mean, if you think you'd get a lower insurance rate for an airbag or a seatbelt or something, imagine what you'd get for almost 99.9% accident-free probability. My God, they'd have to drop the rates right into the basement.
Well, I see that being a strong incentive for people to put the technology in their cars because the insurance rate will go down for those cars.
But that would mean the insurance companies wouldn't make a lot of money.
Let's talk about that for a moment. Let's say...
And they're big enemies to have, Ron.
Let's say that the insurance companies are charging you $150 a month for your insurance.
Okay.
And you have an accident rate that means that according to their actuarial tables, they're going to have to pay out an average of $125 over the next 5 years.
Yeah,
so they're
right.
making a $25 a month profit.
Yeah.
Let's just throw that up in the air.
All right.
Now, let's say that you put this technology on board, and they can only charge you $30 a month because that's all the market will bear.
Yep.
But wait, since they're only spending $1 a month in average payouts, they actually are making more money.
I think making more money with less
revenue is a good thing.
You could be right. And here I was thinking they were going to have you murdered.
Not likely.
No, maybe not. Maybe not. Plus, then, of course, they could plot it all and all the lives that would be saved.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
They've got some very clever mathematicians over there.
With the efficiency of a brain considering the best route to get there, the savings in gas alone equals oil would be astronomical, wouldn't it?
I would believe that we can probably save about 7 to 8% is what our analysis.
Because it would always take the fastest, most direct route.
And it would also, because it's in communications with other vehicles, it would know which routes are clogged and not moving, and would be able to choose alternates.
Hmm. And all of this in the drive to create an autonomous vehicle.
Yes.
Do you think that it would be widely, quickly, you know, with great excitement accepted? In other words, the one big worry, you see, I had was that it would kind of take the fun out of driving. And frankly, a lot of people just love to drive, and it is fun. A lot of times it's a blast, and it wouldn't take that away.
Yeah, I don't see that taking away the fun of driving. I think it would take away the drudgery of driving. There are times when if I have to obey the speed limit and I have to go through the construction zones between Los Angeles and, or say, Barstow and Las Vegas, which seems to be perpetually under construction,
yes,
I would just rather tune out. I mean, why drive that when I could be sitting on my laptop and writing programs or downloading entertainment or, you know, viewing the news or something that's far more interesting than...
I call it the Baker Triangle out there.
There you go.
It's where things go wrong with cars almost supernaturally. All right, hold on, Ron.
Trailer for sale or rent. Rooms to let 50 cents. No phone, no pool, no pets.
ain't got no cigarettes, ah, but 2 hours of pushing broom buys a 8x12 4-bit room. I'm a man of means by no means, king of the road.
7-5-7-2-7-12-95. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from East of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From West of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
All right, here we go. What about the cops? I mean, now, that's no small matter. I mean, little towns have traditionally received a lot of their income from having their officers sit out there on the edge of town right behind a billboard and just slapping people one after another after another after another. They'd starve to death. Because I think your vehicle would observe the speed limit, right?
Yes, in places where it had to do that, yes.
Like where there were signs that said 55 miles an hour, 45, 35, 25, school zone, 15, whatever. Yes. It would observe those.
Yes.
It'll put the cops out of business.
In fact, one of the things that both the DARPA race and the Open Challenge, the IRRF Open Challenge, do is they have speed limits on certain segments that you won't know about in advance until just before the race.
So it's got to observe, I'll be damned, so it's got to.
Yeah.
Is somebody like the Discovery Channel going to cover this? It would be perfect for them.
They actually are planning to cover the DARPA race, and we're hoping that they'll also cover the International Robot Racing Federation race.
Hot diggity dog, because I certainly would love to see it.
I think that Monster Garage has already planned at least one episode around it.
Uh-huh.
And I think Discovery Channel is planning a 6-part series, I've been told. I don't have that directly from them yet.
They do some incredible stuff.
Well, we know that the BBC, NHK, which is Japan's big network, ABC, CBS, and NBC, and Fox are all going to be covering the DARPA race.
Wow.
So it's not just a NASCAR event is really big, but it's covered typically by one channel, and there's a couple of news bites that go to the rest of the places.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be far larger coverage than that. This seems to have struck a nerve with people.
I wonder, yes, it certainly has struck a nerve in me, and I'm trying to figure out what nerve. In other words, what is it about this that's so completely intriguing, I wonder? I wonder if I would like it. Having not just a smart car, but possibly a sentient car, that's amazing to even think about. All right, let's go to the phones. Okay. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Ron Mad Max Inc.
Art, thanks for taking my call. This is Mike 1200, WOAI, San Antonio.
Yes, sir.
My question for Ron is, could these cars be controlled remotely, say, maybe GPS? And if so, then this has got to be one of the scariest shows that I think I've heard, Art.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
You mean could some external force take control of your car, like, say, the police?
Well, let's say, there's an area that they, quote-unquote, whoever they are, these people that...
we know they're out there.
You know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Don't want us in a certain area.
Yeah.
Could these cars be kept out of there? And the other thing, the part that makes this the scariest to me...
Yes?
...is the movement of goods. Ron said it in the beginning. Our government, which anybody that drives professionally knows that our government really doesn't care anything about our safety. That's enough said about that. But he said in the very beginning that this was to move medical goods and supplies, okay? So if this can be done in a car, our government is obviously wanting to do this in trucks. So now we have a situation where these trucks are transporting goods back and forth across the country, and if you control the movement of goods, you control everything.
All right. Well, that's a pretty good rundown there, Ron. I mean, that's probably from the truck driver's perspective. I got a feeling the guy might have been a trucker. But, you know, it's a good question. Right now, there's a mate, one of my friends, one of my very good friends, is a trucker. Does nothing but go back and forth and back and forth across the country, the whole country. That's how he makes his living. Now, autonomous trucks, they take the truck driver's jobs away. What about that?
Well, let's take the first part of his question, which was, can anybody else take control of your vehicle? And the answer would be no. As I said before, I'm a strong proponent of individual liberty,
right,
and free choice.
Right.
And I believe that you still need to be able to control your belongings. And so I would definitely oppose anything that would allow anybody else to take control of your vehicle. However,
but can't you understand how certain agencies of the government would give their right arm to be able to control all the vehicles one way or the other? Oh, he's right. What a gigantic control that would be.
Well, let's talk about the control issue. Is it really control if the vehicle chooses to honor the fact that an emergency is occurring in a certain area and drive a different route to avoid that area, especially if it can communicate to its driver why it's doing what it's doing?
Well, let me give you a real scary scenario, all right? Your vehicle receives a communication that you just blew a court date and there was just a bench warrant issued for you. And so your vehicle says, aha, it locks all your doors so you can't get out, and starts toward the police station to turn your butt in.
I would never, ever become a part of that.
How do you figure?
Well, we have... It's the choice thing.
Your ethics would prevent you from programming that in, and if somebody came to you and said, we want that in this car...
I'm sorry, it's not going to happen.
Not going to do it, huh?
I'd sooner not go into that business than to deliver something like that. Now, they have ways of dealing with that, which they do already. They have... the job is not to put the police out of work. The job is to let them do their job. And if there is a bench warrant, then they can go to your house and serve it just like they do now.
It just seems like so much new technology. Most new technology, Ron, honestly, just runs into the Fourth Amendment doing 90 miles an hour broadside.
Well, each new technology has been a two-edged sword. For example, in the 70s, a lot of people with the foresight to see the impact that computers would have on people's lives believed that computers would be used by governments to control everybody.
That's right.
Well, maybe some of that has occurred.
Maybe.
But on the other hand, it's been a much larger tool for freedom, and the Internet is a classic example.
That, I guess, I must agree with for now.
Okay. Yeah. And I believe that in any new technology, in robotics and sentience, if it ever can arrive, if it's possible, will be a two-edged sword. And there will be some cases where people use it for evil things or for control. And there will be many more where it's used to enhance freedom and enhance your capabilities.
Let's talk about enhancing freedom for a second, Ron. Right now, we have a lot of young, courageous men and women fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan and around the world in the war on terror. Why wouldn't it be incredibly worth our while to have fighting vehicles that could be perhaps sentient, perhaps just very, very intelligent from a machine point of view, either way, smart enough to, without our men and women, who could remain well behind lines, go in and fight wars, robot wars, I don't care, against people?
Let's look at what happened in Iraq. The biggest scare that we had was when a supply line with people, drivers, went astray and was captured.
That's a true statement. Yes, that's where Jessica...
That's right.
Was, yes.
And the rest of her team.
Yes.
And that was a very unpleasant experience and a very scary experience for all of us, and especially for her.
Sure.
That never would have happened if they had already been able to perform their mandate to have one-third of their vehicles be autonomous, the supply vehicles.
In order to have this autonomous supply vehicle that you talk about, and to have it be effective in a place or a war zone like Iraq, your autonomous vehicle would have to make choices about who to shoot at and kill, and maybe even what other vehicle to blow off the face of the earth.
It would make choices about how to avoid those things.
But yes, but in defense of itself, in the end, faced with an Iraqi vehicle with Iraqi guys in it, it might have to blow it off the face of the earth.
It might have to outrun it.
You're telling me, now come on now, we're talking a war here. You kill the enemy in war. So I can see you want to stay away from that, don't you? You don't want to put a gun on that thing.
I don't want to put a gun on that thing.
Well, you see, you'd have to put a gun on
it.
In that situation, you'd have to put a gun on.
You know, DARPA may buy the technology from somebody.
They
may put a gun on it. But they have stated that their purpose is for supply line vehicles and for the delivery of supplies and medicines. And I have to go with that. And at this point, I think anybody in their right mind would not want to put guns on that unless there were some very compelling reasons. And they would have to be...
Christine with attitude.
They would. But at this point, I mean, look at the lives we'd have saved. This machine has the capability to do reckoning by landmarks completely. So it can drive and know where it's going and not make a wrong turn. And it would not have gotten itself into the trouble that our human drivers did in that situation.
We may be getting to the root of why DARPA really dropped you.
It's maybe, you know, who knows?
It's your attitude. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Ron Wildman Fink, actually. Yes, hello.
Hey, Art.
Yes.
How you doing? It's a pleasure to speak to you.
Thank you.
Two questions for your guests and a quick comment.
Sure.
I am a truck driver, and the last caller took a little bit of my thunder. But there is available now on trucks, and I've never personally driven one, with the collision avoidance software they have in some of the trucks. I was wondering if he's using some of that equipment in his work. And also, I'd like to know how much longer we're going to have jobs, because it sounds like they're just going to get rid of us.
Well, there is that aspect of it, isn't there? So do you know anything about the current collision avoidance?
Let me go there real quickly for you. First of all, I think that our stuff is going to be an order of magnitude past the current collision avoidance.
That's what he's worried about.
But the other thing is that and you touched on this in the last segment, but basically I expect acceptance to be very slow. For example,
my caller.
Yes.
Right.
There will be a lot of occasions where a new technology takes time to be accepted and trusted. And once it's trusted, what will actually happen? Well,
you see, this man is a truck driver. He's seeing it sneak up on him right now. He just mentioned it. Collision avoidance. And they can even sometimes tell exactly where a truck is. And all kinds of things are really invading a trucker's life. And you're kind of drawing a roadmap here of, eventually,
well,
you know, no truck driver at all.
It probably will take a while to be accepted, and it will probably be a long while. And when it does, it will do it by bits and pieces, and it will just take some of the drudgery away at first. And then maybe you'll be able to sleep during long hauls.
Will all this happen before my caller dies?
Well, without putting on my, predictive capabilities, you know, here. I can't see into the future yet.
You're in a better position to call on this one than we are, though. I mean, you're in development of this stuff, so how about it?
I believe it'll go into, in a gradual way. I'm looking at more capabilities in 5 and more in 10. And, and then this pervasive thing probably in 10 to 15.
Sounds, well, caller, I don't know how old you are, but sounds like maybe in your lifetime.
Yeah, well, it sounds like a lot closer than that, to be honest with you. So one more comment real quick.
Sure.
Yes.
If they can put a gun on it, they will put a gun on it. You better believe that.
I see. I agree with that.
Thanks a lot, Mark, for keeping us awake at night.
Take care, sir, and good luck. I mean, he's right. You know he's right. You're admirably, I don't know, on the peace road, obviously, Ron, and you get marks for that. But, man, they'd run over you like yesterday's garbage. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Ron Fink.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, good morning to both you gentlemen.
And to you, ma'am. Where are you?
I'm in Florida.
All the way over in Florida. Okay.
What I would like to know is how practical would his car be for someone who's blind?
Ah. Oh, my guess is real practical.
Yes, real practical. In fact, that's one of the market segments we're looking at. We're forming an alliance with somebody who already does enhanced mobility controls for vehicles right now as a marketing alliance for what we're planning. So we see that people who are blind and people who are handicapped literally can have it handled for them. And that would be great.
Well, that's wonderful because
just a whole new... Imagine a whole new level of freedom that can be yours if you're impaired in any way. You can still do whatever it is that you want that you can't do now. I think that would be one of the ways that this enhances freedom. A good example.
Boy, I certainly agree with that. Right down the line, and for her, of course, it would be the incredible amount of freedom that comes with being able to go places.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh. All right. Listen, do you have any, do you want to give out your email address?
Sure.
You're welcome to if you do, or do you have a website, or have you written a book, or?
Okay. Well, let's hit that real quick.
All right. Let's.
We have rapidrobots.com. So if you go to www.rapidrobots.com, that will be our website.
All right.
And on the website is some of our sponsors. And we're very grateful to the help that we've received so far in this endeavor. And also, please check out the International Robot Racing Federation, which is www.irrf.org.
All right.
And you can also link to it from my site. That will talk about the races and about the concept of using competitions as a way to advance technology faster.
Any robot photographs on there?
Well, we're adding to it every day.
All right.
So feel free to check back often.
www.rapidrobots.com.
Yes.
All together. RAPIDROBOTS.
Yes.
Rapid Robots. All
and
right.
The other one is IRRF.org.
Well, you know, you're the kind of guy who's going to be fun to have back on again because I guess this field is really moving fast, right? In more ways than one. And this race that's coming up is going to be it's going to be for these robot vehicles to get from point A to point B, a long distance through, just open land.
They're going to have to run the word just slipped my brain. They are going
the gauntlet?
To have, gauntlet, yes.
Gauntlet.
They are going to have to run the gauntlet. It will be a challenge.
And it'll probably be videoed. It'll probably be on the... any idea when the Discovery Channel might run such a thing?
Well, we're in Popular Science in the March issue. We're also in the Journal of Automotive Engineering, also in March. And we are in Wired.
Oh, and in Wired, too. You made Wired, huh?
Yes.
That's hot stuff.
And also, we talked about the Racing Federation there. In all three of those venues. And we don't know exactly, but we're in contact with someone at the Nevada Film Commission who said that there's already some movies and documentaries planned to be filmed here in Nevada.
Then we will be watching for you, and it has been a pleasure having you on the program.
I'm very happy to be here.
A lot of
and
fun.
We definitely should talk again.
All right. Well, we shall. Good night, Ron.
Good night, Art.
Right. End of program, folks. I'm sorry we're out of time. What a blast it was, though. Don't forget, you're going to want to take a moment, and you're going to want to think very hard about your prediction that I'm going to be taking coming up on the 28th or the 31st. That, you know, that's kind of a big deal every year. But for tonight, this night anyway, and from the high deserts, I'm Art Bell. Good night.
Midnight in the desert, shooting stars across the sky. This magical journey will take us on a ride, filled with the longing, searching for the truth. Will we make it to tomorrow? Will the sun shine on you? Midnight in the day.